American administration unveiled a so-called peace plan for Ukraine, which was, it later emerged, pretty much written by the Kremlin. As we discussed yesterday, they've now revealed or released a foreign policy strategy statement that has been greeted very warmly by the Kremlin. In other words, Donald Trump's administration is currently, if not dancing to the tune being played by Vladimir Putin, then working very, very furiously to win his approval. Why?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the peer leading a review of NHS maternity care has warned the situation is much worse than she expected. Baroness Amos has warned unacceptable care is leading to tragic consequences for victims. She's expected to publish her full findings and recommendations next year. Maternity campaigner Rebecca Matthews is concerned the review will lack substance.
It seems as though it is heading the same way that other reviews have gone in the past, leading to some recommendations, but no teeth. We really need some mechanisms that are going to hold people and hold systems to account. That's what the families deserve.
The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who ordered the investigation, says the failures cannot be ignored. Birmingham's major hospitals have declared a major incident because of flu. University's Hospitals Birmingham says it's treating an exceptional number of patients. Figures out last week showed flu admissions across England were 50% higher than the same point in 2024. A man has been charged with the rape of two 14-year-old girls in Bolton. Sultani Bakatash, a 28-year-old Afghan national, is accused of attacking the girls early on Sunday morning. He is due to appear before Salford Magistrates Court this morning. Danger to life weather warnings have been extended as Storm Bram moves across the UK. Parts of Northern Ireland, northwest Scotland, South Wales and Devon are covered by the Met Office Amber Alert. There is already some rail disruption with some lines in Scotland set to be suspended later. Ministers have unveiled a union flag-themed colour scheme for Great British Railways. Nationalised trains will be painted in red, white and blue with matching branding at stations and online. Three operators have returned to public control in the last year, with more to follow in 2026. The Transport Secretary, Heidi Alexander, told LBC the new look will appear gradually.
We're going to be sensible about this. When trains are being repainted as part of their normal maintenance cycle, or as we get new rolling stock onto the network, that will carry the new branding. But
in the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 96.37. That's down 7. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.14. LBC weather, wet and windy for most of the UK as the storm moves in. The most severe conditions in the northwest. A high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible, and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Good morning. It's 3 minutes after 10. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Would you like to know what the hardest thing about my... Of course, you're not remotely interested, are you? Probably just tuned in by accident, got no idea who I am. But anyway, would you like to know what the hardest thing about my job is some mornings? No, it's not that. But the... the difficulty sometimes of thinking that something is hugely important and not having that thought or fear very widely reflected across the rest of this so-called profession, across the rest of this media in this country at the moment. I talking to Simon Marks yesterday about the strategy statement, the foreign policy strategy statement released by the White House, was the only time, really, that I felt seen, that I felt my fears and confusion reflected by somebody I respect, somebody who I think is more across the facts than I am. And there's not a lot of it about. And it takes a peculiar form of, I would like to say confidence, but I think sometimes it's also arrogance, to find yourself thinking everybody else is wrong and we're right. Everybody else should be a lot more exercised about this moment, about this event, about this development. But they're not. They are either ignoring it completely, or in the case of one columnist in the Times, I should probably double check, but they appear to have written a whole piece about this without once mentioning that the national security strategy has been greeted by the Kremlin with undisguised, or at least ill-disguised, glee. How could anybody do that? How could anybody write an article? As I say, I should probably double check. But if you are talking about the foreign policy strategy of your, I'm going to say your closest ally, that's probably not true, but we get a little bit dewy-eyed, don't we, about the legacy of the Second World War and the role that the United States played in changing the game post-Pearl Harbor. But let's just say one of our staunchest allies, a country essentially birthed by Britannia. It's a slightly uncomfortable figure of speech, but a country birthed by Britannia, one of our oldest, staunchest allies, the other half of the so-called special relationship, has got us in the crosshairs, has got the whole of Europe in the crosshairs, in its crosshairs. And we either don't know what to do, we're either so daunted by the scale of this development that we are doing that thing, we're not looking up, we're just looking away, we're pretending that it's not happening because thinking about it is too traumatic. We are, I think in a lot of cases, probably in the British media, people have climbed too far up a pole of absurdity and ridiculousness that they don't know how to climb down. If you used the phrase Trump derangement syndrome, for example, to describe people expressing concern or warning about the obvious direction of traffic, how on earth do you? It's a bit like Brexit. If you told people to vote for Brexit, how on earth do you return to the subject without wearing a hair shirt and indulging in at least 3 hours of self-flagellation, as well as shouting sorry from the top of Nelson's Column for an entire morning? How would you do that if you told people to vote for Brexit, or if you told people to calm down a bit about Donald Trump? How do you deal with the new reality where Brexit is obviously a disaster and Donald Trump has essentially put the whole of Europe and specifically the United Kingdom in the crosshairs? He has, I'm going to say this slowly, he has sided with Vladimir Putin against the United Kingdom. The president of the United States of America has sided with Vladimir Putin against the United Kingdom. Against the whole of Europe, in fact. But I don't know whether we're ready to speak as Europeans yet, as opposed to speaking simply as Brits. And I know that it is sometimes hard to believe that there's any purpose or plan behind this at all. And I know that sometimes it can be quite dispiriting to find yourself searching for the rationale, searching for the rationale behind what is going on. But I don't think we can help ourselves, and I don't think we've got, I don't know what else we can do. How on earth do you solve a problem if you don't know what the problem is? How on earth do you discuss what Donald Trump is doing now without wondering why he is doing it? Can you answer that question? That's going to be the phone-in, by the way. I'll give you a quick heads-up. 03456060973 will be, is already, the number that you need. Why is Donald Trump attacking Europe in such extraordinary ways? I don't understand why. It doesn't strengthen his position at home, does it? Does it? I mean, it doesn't improve the economy. It doesn't bring down prices. It doesn't do any of the things that foreign policy... It doesn't enhance peace. It doesn't increase the likelihood of peace in Europe, giving Putin what he wants after he's invaded a sovereign country. So next time you invade a sovereign country, fill your boots, mate. It does the polar opposite of promoting peace. I know what you're thinking. How on earth could the winner of the FIFA, the inaugural FIFA Peace Prize, not be in the business of promoting peace? But, well, that's for the judging panel. Why is he doing it? Why is he doing it? Why is he targeting Europe? I mean, the language is a curious combination of dangerous and ridiculous. He doesn't even mention the word democracy until page 16. A 29-page document described by Vladimir Putin's press secretary as largely consistent with our vision doesn't mention democracy until page 16, and then only three times across the entire document. Because it is a statement of intent. It is a statement of rejection of democracy. He favours countries. I mean, he's done it with China already this morning. He favours leaders that are repelled by democracy. He favours leaders that rubbish democracy. He looks at Putin and he looks at Xi and he thinks, I'd like a bit of that. I mean, you see what I mean about those mornings where we just have to pause and take stock. What's the alternative? What is the alternative? He doesn't matter. So the United States national security strategy denigrates democracy and attacks allies, among whom we are arguably the oldest and the staunchest. I'll say that again. The United States national security strategy has absolutely delighted the Kremlin and disgusted every leader in Europe. It denigrates democracy and it demonizes allies. It delights enemies, including war criminals, and it angers or dismays friends and allies. Right? I mean, what do I do now? What do I do? Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Is this like, why is this not the major topic of conversation on every news platform? Does it all go back to February? Is this old news? Is that appalling behaviour in the Oval Office when Volodymyr Zelensky visited the White House? The reason why some people are perhaps not as bamboozled, discombobulated, disgusted, whatever you want to call it. What on earth is happening? Maybe, is it a big deal? I mean, does it matter if we slightly romanticised or mythologised the importance of the United States over the last 100 years, 80 years? I don't think so. The idea of the United States dancing to the Kremlin's tune while telling Europe to go whistle surely has a significance that reaches far beyond its own shores and well into ours. Why is he doing this? And what is it likely to lead to? Could be the two most important questions of our age. And listen, I hate hyperbole. This is what I mean. This is why I needed your indulgence at the top of the show today. I needed you just to sort of give me a little pat on the head and throw me a biscuit. Because it's really hard sometimes to do this thing. Why is everybody else not talking about this? Why is nobody else as concerned, as confused, as worried as I am, as we are? Or maybe you're not, but hopefully you are now. Why is he doing it? The idea that, here we go, Europe is facing civilizational erasure. That's the kind of thing, when I was on Twitter a couple of years ago, that made me realize the direction of traffic that the platform was going to go in after Elon Musk bought it. You realised that those weird accounts, which we've recently discovered, are largely based in sort of developing countries where people have realised they can make a few quid by promoting white supremacist... People with brown skin can make a few quid promoting white supremacist ideology on platforms where Elon Musk will pay them for their popularity. But the kind of bilge that would come out of, you know, War on the West or whatever it was, and these ludicrous pictures increasingly created by AI, pretending that every crime committed in every country west of the Bosphorus was committed by an immigrant or somebody foreign. That whole narrative, that whole ideology, the great replacement theory, which is a byword for being thicker than mince, racist and frightened of everything, frightened of London, frightened of buses, frightened of tube trains, frightened of gingerbread men. More on that later. But this whole idea that what we once laughed at is now driving the foreign policy of the most powerful country on the planet. And they don't believe it. Of course they don't believe it. They come to London and go to the theatre and don't find themselves in countries that are, or in cities that are more frightening than Washington, D.C., or more dangerous than New York. It's a blatant and obvious lie. If you've never left the boondocks, then you might fall for it. You might think, God, Europe is in all sorts of danger. But if you live here or you visit here, you know that it isn't. It's simply not true. You are infinitely, immeasurably safer in London than you are in Washington or New York or Chicago or Detroit or any city, regardless of whether it's Democrat-run or Republican-run. But he's selling this idea that Europe is undergoing an economic decline eclipsed by the real and more stark prospect of civilizational erasure, which is precisely what Vladimir Putin wants people to believe. And again, like Brexit, sorry, I sometimes worry that too many roads lead back to Brexit, but the way that you turned immigration into the major factor of Brexit was by persuading people in towns and villages where there wasn't any that they were about to be invaded. It's why they hate London so much, these people, because London is an absolute paragon of multicultural virtue. It's an incredible city where we all rub along wonderfully, despite coming from all corners of the globe, and it works quite beautifully. Yes, we've got problems. Yes, we've got crime. But, you know, nothing says integration better than having a second generation Muslim man elected mayor of our capital city three terms on the trot. All of the things that are supposed to be negatives are positives when you look at them through the lens of London. So why is Donald Trump doing this? Why is Donald Trump attacking Europe? 0345-6060-973 is the number that you need. That's what I want. And listen, anything goes today. I mean, maybe not. Yeah, even the obvious. Let's just make a list. It's seasonal, isn't it? It was just supposed to make lists in December. So, you know, accusing Europe of facing civilizational erasure, a statement so obviously racist and wrong that I think not long ago I wouldn't even have bothered addressing it. If it was being made by Billy Buncher numbers on social media with a bulldog avatar and 406 flags in his profile, you just sort of think, who takes this nonsense seriously? But now we know. Donald Trump or his closest advisors or all of them are on the side of dictatorships. They are against human rights. They are denigrating democracy. They are lying about and attacking historic allies. Donald Trump is siding with Vladimir Putin against Europe. And I don't know why. And I'm hoping that you do. Why is he doing this? 0345-6060-973 is the number you need. Why on earth is the United States administration, A, siding with Vladimir Putin against Europe, B, denigrating democracy and attacking Europe in deeply dishonest terms, and question C, or question three, where does it lead? What is this likely to accomplish? I mean, is it the same question when I say, why is he doing it? Am I asking you, what is the end goal? I kind of am, aren't I? Maybe they're slightly different questions. Why is he doing it? It might be to sort of muster up a domestic scenario and not actually have much to do with what's happening on the world stage. But why is he doing this? Why is he attacking his allies and lionizing his country's enemies? And what will it lead to? What will it lead to? Hit the numbers now. You will get through. I think this is among the most important things that we have ever talked about. It is the abandonment of the post-Second World War transatlantic alliance. It is laid out in black and white print across, by Simon's reckoning, about 2.5 pages of the document. The Second World War transatlantic alliance, the stuff we studied at school, the stuff that has secured safety for the United Kingdom for the best part of a century. And it's gone. He's set fire to it. And I don't know. People don't seem to have noticed. And if they've noticed, they don't seem to care. I can't answer that bit yet, but we can perhaps answer the first bit. Why is he doing it? Why is he doing this? And where is it going to lead? Hit the numbers now. You will get through. Don't hold back on this, because you think, you know, this is one for the big brains or the clever clogs, because they don't know. They're ignoring it. Column in the Times manages to write an article which appears to be in praise of what Donald Trump is doing, which, of course, was a lucrative business model in the 1930s to talk up what was being done by our obvious enemies, and not mention the fact that the Kremlin love it. I suppose you couldn't. Could you write a column for the Times about why this is a necessary warning without mentioning that the Kremlin love it? Because if you mention that the Kremlin love it, then your whole argument falls apart immediately. So just don't mention it. Just don't mention it. It's 20 past 10. 0345 6060 973.
LBC.
Train to Brighton with the besties. Immaculate vibes, as always. But I bet my ice skating's going to be pure chaos.
Oh, Em, you better hold my hand. Oh, I'm going up.
No, styled it out. I've got this.
Last one to the other side buys the hot chocolate.
Back on the train. Only fell twice.
Low-key legend.
We have to do this every year.
Download the Southern Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel and off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story.
Looking for a fixed passive income backed by real demand? With ulezprosperity.com, you buy the car, we rent it from you for a set period. You stay the legal owner and we pay you up to £600 per month in fixed rental income. No hassle, no maintenance, no tenants. It's a straightforward asset-backed rental agreement. Visit ulezprosperity.com for conditions and to learn more. That's ulezprosperity.com. Simple, steady, secure.
They did it again. Flour instead of flowers. On my birthday. I'm 95 minutes late. But it's hard to leave when you've shared so much. Your postcode, your gluten intolerance. Then I saw it. 25% off your first Ocado shop. Plus, free delivery. And I just knew I'd found the online supermarket of my dreams. Ocado. Life delivered. Geographical restrictions. Min spend £60. Max saving £20. Charges and Christmas restrictions apply. New customers only. Terms at Ocado.com.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
21 minutes after 10 is the time. Simon Marks's headline yesterday for his splendid opinion piece in the I newspaper pretty much says it all. As Russia praises Trump's new security strategy, the UK is in trouble. Not if you are the Times columnist Melanie Phillips, who somehow sees this obvious existential threat to the post-war settlement as being motivated by a desire to preserve Christian civilization. These people are quite bonkers. And I was right. The reference to Vladimir Putin completely avoids the reality of the Kremlin praising what Donald Trump's administration has announced and somehow manages to cobble together this sentence. A frankly astonishing, what would you call it, blancmange of the facts. The problem is that Putin imagines himself as a latter-day Russian emperor leading the restoration of Christian Europe. This is held to justify his invasion of Ukraine and potentially the Baltic states too. Far from saving Europe, therefore, he menaces it. That's in Rupert Murdoch's Times today. So he's keeping Trump sweet, even as his columnists fail signally to mention that the Kremlin absolutely loves the direction of traffic that Donald Trump is driving in. Dave's in York. Dave, what do you reckon?
Everything that... James, good morning.
Hello, Dave.
Everything I thought Trump would do is coming to pass, but he's doing it a lot faster than I thought.
Even this.
I thought it would take maybe another year, but is there's nobody telling him any common sense, James. He's just full-barrel bonkers.
That it's interesting you say that. So we have a conversation, obviously, before we come on air. So some mornings it's longer than others. And Eleanor very much posits the possibility that he is just mad and that we're wasting our time sometimes trying to see method in the madness. But then you've got the Project 2025 statement of intent and you've got the security strategy, the national security strategy, stating across 29 pages exactly where they are and what they're doing. So the possibility that Trump doesn't know what's going on is real, that Trump is just going along with this stuff because the people around him are telling him to. But it still doesn't answer the question of what it is designed to achieve, does it?
No, Well, I don't know what it achieved, to be honest, James. I don't know what lies behind what he's doing.
Well, why then are the Kremlin celebrating?
Because he's given the green light to Putin to just carry on doing what he's doing.
And then we circle back to the question of why would he want to give the green light to Putin to carry on doing what he's doing, and you say, I don't know.
No, that question, it's because of the mineral rights in Ukraine.
As in, they think somewhere down the line there'll be a payoff for them, but they're just as likely to get a payoff if Ukraine stays under Ukrainian sovereignty as they are if in fact, they're more likely, with Ukraine as an ally, they're more likely to strike a favourable deal with the owners of that territory than they are if Putin moves into it, or if Putin gets handed it.
As I said to your colleague on the phone, there's four great powers that are going to be US, China, Russia and India, and they'll just carve up the world to suit them.
And he wants, and he sees that future, or the people around him see that future, and are preparing for that reality. I mean, at the moment, Europe would be very much one of those powers. But, of course, the answer to the question of why is he attacking Europe, to take Dave's analysis to its logical conclusion, would be to remove Europe from the carve-up, to remove Europe. I mean, what would stand among those four powers? What would stand for liberalism, for democracy, for decency? What would actually stand for citizens' rights, for equality? Would the United States under Donald Trump? Would China, under any regime that it's had in the last 100 years, would India under Modi, would Russia under Putin, no chance. Would Europe, with a European Union in the box seat? Yes, it would. It would actually stand against tyranny, stand in favour of democracy, stand against persecution. And all four of those powers arguably hate that very prospect. Therefore, the answer to the question of why Donald Trump is attacking Europe has, unexpectedly, got its first answer. What will be the second? Mike's in Marlow. Mike, what would you like to say?
Yes, good morning, James. I think it's as simple as peace prize. I really do.
Well, I mean, two thoughts. Number one, the Nobel jury are a little bit more...
It's gone this year. It's already gone, isn't it?
No, I don't just mean that. I just think they're a little bit more honest than perhaps the FIFA Peace Prize judges, Mike. I mean, and also, it's not really a peace if you say to the invading party, tell us what you need to stop killing people for a week so that I can pick up a peace prize next year and then you can carry on again. I just don't think that they would
be... Well, he's quite prepared to give away all the land that Putin's taken already.
And more.
So he obviously couldn't
and
care
more,
less
and
about...
And more, and more.
And more, yes. Okay. But he obviously couldn't care less about Ukraine, could he? He couldn't care less about Zelensky. He couldn't care less about fairness because, you know, if I go and steal a chicken out of Tesco's and they catch me on the way out, oh, by the way, keep the chicken.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. It doesn't add up.
No.
So I think everything that he does is ego-led. And I think his ego has taken him to...
The only way we can quickly get a peace deal is by giving Vladimir Putin enough to make him stop. And of course, no matter that he'll start again in 10 minutes, he'll stop for long enough for me to be able to claim that I've fixed another war. What's it up to now? 473 wars. Oh, is it only eight? No, I thought it was 473. So he's served eight wars. You've got to laugh, Mike. You've got to laugh, haven't you?
I know. You've got to laugh with this.
You've got to laugh.
It's bonkers.
That works. That fits the parameters of plausibility, but it doesn't come close to answering the question of why he's attacking Europe, why he's attacking you and me, our country, our traditions, our values.
Why do we allow him to be in charge of this? Why isn't this European-led? It's a European country. It's a European problem.
Yeah.
Why are we letting that fat, egotistic, whatever you want to call him, on the
Piggy.
Other side of the pond govern things?
Well, that's that.
Why are we allowing it?
Well, that is a consequence of the Second World War Transatlantic Alliance. And actually, that argument that the European allies have been complacent in the face of US leadership is clear, absolutely clear. And it's extraordinary how it fits two narratives. The first narrative it fits is that America has been determined to be the world's policeman. The America has been determined since 1945, or since before 1945, since Pearl Harbor probably, to be the guarantor guarantor of peace in Europe, to be the upholder of peace in Europe. That's why they are in the driving seat and have been historically in the driving seat of NATO. So why would other European leaders step up to a plate that America is so signally determined to occupy? That's narrative number one. Narrative number two speaks to exactly the same circumstances and allows a narrative of grievance. Why is America shouldering all of the burden of this? Why is America paying all the bills for this? That's Donald Trump's position. But the answer, of course, is because it really, really wanted to. Why aren't the Europeans doing more? Well, because they didn't have to, because America really, really wanted to be in charge. Donald Trump was taking out full-page adverts in American newspapers in 1987 attacking NATO. I'm sure it's a complete coincidence that he did so shortly after returning from his first-ever trip to Moscow. Absolute coincidence. Nothing to see here, lads. Absolutely nothing suspicious about that. But both narratives work. NATO... America does far too much for NATO because it has always insisted on doing so. Narrative two, America does far too much for NATO. Therefore, European countries are remiss and complacent and should have done more historically. But we are where we are, and we are in a place where our oldest and staunchest ally is essentially siding with our enemies and attacking us. Why? 0345 6060 973. Thomas Watts, how's your headlines?
Large parts of the UK are being hit by strong winds and heavy rain brought by Storm Bram. There is disruption to flights and rail services with 4 amber danger to life warnings issued by the Met Office. The head of an investigation into maternity care failings has insisted it will deliver change. Interim findings from Baroness Amos say unacceptable care is leading to tragic consequences for victims. Several major hospitals have declared major incidents because of a rising number of flu cases. University Hospitals Birmingham says it is treating an exceptional number of patients. LBC weather, west and windy as the storm moves in. The most severe conditions towards the northwest of the UK, a high of 15 degrees.
This is LBC.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
At Morrison's this Christmas, choose 3 bottles of wine for £20 with your More card. Mix and match on wines like Canti Prosecco, Mudhouse, Villa Maria, 19 Crimes, Levier Ferme, Campo Viejo and more. Morrison's, making more of Christmas. Majority of stores online, subject to availability. Exclude Scotland and Morrison's daily. More card app required, 18 plus. Selected 75 centilitre bottles, max 3 online. Please drink responsibly.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. Sky Sports will play more than 50 Premier League games and the PDC Darts Championship. While over on Sky TV, Amadeus and Sweet Pea Stranger Things is on Netflix.
Get Sky Sports, Sky TV and Netflix for a most wonderful price in time for Christmas. Go to sky.com. Sky, believe in better. Requires Sky Stream and relevant Sky TV subscriptions. Minimum broadband speed of 25 megabits per second recommended. 18 plus.
While all the Whos of Whoville were at McDonald's eating, the Grinch from his lair started plotting and scheming. Gherkin-flavored fries and odd socks will send them crackers. So try the Grinch's new meal and head down to Macca's. Until 4th of Jan from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary while stocks last. Grinched for adults.
When you buy a BMW-approved used electric car, there are no surprises. You'll find the largest range and the widest choice. Naturally. Every car has been meticulously checked by qualified BMW technicians. Hardly a plot twist. And they always come with a battery health report and at least 12 months unlimited mileage BMW warranty. Just as you'd expect. BMW approved used electric cars. Nothing new here. Search BMW approved used electric. Obviously.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60973.
33 minutes after 10. I you know things are going quite well in conversations like this when you find yourself thinking, I think that the contributions we get are as valid as any from the professionals. So we'll get more informed and expert analysis of the observable. But the question of what's going on under the bonnet, why is he doing this, I think your guess is as good as anybody's. I wouldn't mind asking Fiona Hill. I found her, when I interviewed her for Full Disclosure, to be an extraordinarily accomplished person and her insights to this. And she was, of course, in the first Trump administration with responsibility for Russian relations. She might have a clearer eye, but I don't think it's got anything to do with the Peace Prize. I don't think it's got anything to do with minerals. I just don't. The two suggestions that possibly are becoming more plausible rather than less. Let me read you one from Lee, who's in Lviv and has been working there pretty much from the get-go. Here you go. Why is he turning on Europe? It's not about minerals in Ukraine. It's not about some grand peace plan or a Nobel Prize. With Trump, and this is Occam's razor, I think, it's always about money. Money for him, money for his family, money for the circle of people around him, like Witkoff, whose own business interests are intertwined with post-Soviet oligarch capital. Europe is the problem for that project. The EU's regulations, enforcement and transparency rules are exactly what block the kind of opaque, oligarch-friendly deals that have defined Trump's career and now shape his foreign policy. That's why he's siding with billionaire backers and tech bros against a rules-based Europe. Not to end a war, but to end the obstacles to their personal enrichment and to accountability. And as if by magic, up pops Elon Musk this weekend to attack the European Union. So next time you hear Farage talking about how wonderful Putin is, or indeed how wonderful Trump is, or how wonderful Elon Musk is, just have Lee's words echoing in the back of your mind. The EU's regulations, enforcements and transparency rules are exactly what block the kind of opaque, oligarch-friendly deals that have defined Trump's career and now shape his foreign policy. I don't care where the money's coming from, I just care how much there is. One of his sons gave the game away, characteristically thick fashion, by saying that we haven't been able to deal with American banks for years, so we've been dealing with Russian banks. Oligarch-friendly deals. Who is likely to make the biggest noise about that? The unacceptability of becoming essentially state-sanctioned launderers of some of the worst regimes in the world? Who is most likely to stand up against that? A relatively lily-livered Europe, which is still in the process of trying to assemble a backbone. Rules, regulations, transparency, democracy, none of these things appear in any great way in this 29-page document because they hate all of them. What do you want to be able to do? I just want rich people to carve up the world and give me as much. And it's Occam's razor. The other Occam's razor, of course, the age-old adage that the simplest answer is usually the correct one leads us to, where Paul takes us in a message, leads us to compromat and the idea that they have something on him and therefore he will do whatever they want. I've always found that too pat. You know, it does seem odd that he returns from his first ever visit to Moscow in 1987 and immediately launches attacks on NATO. It does seem odd that he's done nothing in either term as president that is likely to have upset Vladimir Putin. It does seem odd that the Americans would announce a peace deal for Ukraine that experts quickly established was almost certainly written in the Kremlin, in Russian, and then clumsily translated into English. It does seem odd that they would announce a foreign policy strategy that is greeted with horror and disbelief by their allies and loved by their enemies, loved by the Kremlin. Oh, and by Melanie Phillips in the Times. But Occam's razor? Really? All the way back to compromat? It's got to be more than that. And where does it end? Maybe that's the problem. If it is Occam's razor and if it is self-enrichment and blackmail, if it's a combination of those or one or the other, blackmail or self-enrichment, then that's the stupidest question of all. Where does it end? Because there is no plan, there is no policy, there is no roadmap. It's got absolutely nothing to do with where we are likely to be in 10 years. There's no intention. There's just consequences. The question of where are we likely to be in 10 years is not one that they're asking themselves. They're answering different questions. How rich will we be in 10 years? How safe will I be in 10 years? Where will Europe be in 10 years is not something that they care about. That much is clear. But we should. We bloody have to. Johnny's in Battersea. Johnny, what made you pick up the phone?
Good morning, by the way.
Hello,
I lived in the States through the whole of the first Trump presidency and sort of continued to sort of go back and forth between here and there.
Yeah.
My wife is American. We basically sold our place there as soon as the election was over and moved here for fear of what was going to become of the country. So I follow it all very closely and that sort of thing. But I think the two points that you bring up, one of which is, why is he doing this? Unfortunately, it really is that simple to me. I think obviously there is something, there is an obvious gain that he wants to have financially, that the people around him, like Witkoff, everything from, you know, hosting Mohammed bin Bonesaw, and then also getting an entire green light for Trump hotels and buildings. There's obviously a self-interest there. And I think also there is probably a blackmail element or a Moscow's puppet element that's been in play for quite a long time. But I also wanted to say your point about why is everyone not up in arms about this? Yeah. And I think it's two things, one of which is, firstly, I think that you're so worn down by the drivel that comes out of his mouth that you just become numb to it. And so when something as outrageous as this pops up, it barely registers with some people. And I also think that, you know, a friend of mine came up with a term. He's like, America is just Uber eating its way into oblivion, in that everyone is just kind of going about their lives. And I was in New York when the mayoral election happened, and you would barely know such a sort of difficult and important sort of thing was going on in the city.
It was just, really?
Everyone is just going about their business. It's you know, we went up to Maine, and it's just, it's bizarre. It's almost like everyone is in just some kind of daze and either thinking, well, it won't really affect me. But they don't understand that by him cutting his ties with Europe and with England, it will have a snap back effect on them, and they just are oblivious to it almost. It's quite bizarre.
A bit like the tariffs, I suppose, which are impacting on people's lives in entirely negative ways, and yet somehow the fury that should be prompted by these policies is absent.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's interesting when you talk to people there about inflation and about the tariffs, there's still people there, and a large proportion that are still blaming Biden. Like, well, living standards haven't improved because he's still trying to fix, as and I swear this is true, as he's still trying to fix Bidenflation, they call it.
Really?
And, you know, they just still think, and the tariffs, people just aren't putting two and two together. It's noticing that Trump has imposed tariffs on China buying soybeans, and therefore American farming income has plummeted. So his response is to swan in with a $12 billion, I think it is.
Yeah, bailout.
which makes him look to these farmers like, oh, yeah, he's saving us. And that's the dangerous thing, is people just aren't connecting the dots.
He did it last time. He bailed out the farmers last time as a consequence of his
own
policies.
Absolutely.
And of course, tariffs and bailouts are paid for by U.S. consumers, are paid for by U.S. citizens. So, actually, you've reminded me of something else. I probably should have clocked a little sooner. The answer to the question of why he's attacking Europe is the same answer to the question of why he's attacking the U.S. media, why he's trying to turn the Oval Office into a room where people literally ask him, on a scale of 1 to 10, how wonderful are you? There was a question yesterday, I'll try and dig it out, that even by the standards of parody was worthy of a double take. I mean, you saw the conference where...
There was the thing about the video. He was going to release the video of the second boat strike. And a couple of weeks ago, or 5 days ago, he said, yes, we're going to release it. And then yesterday, the reporter said, you said you were going to... He goes, oh, I didn't say that. You said that.
Yeah, and then attacked the reporter, a woman, inevitably.
Absolutely.
Attacked, called her obnoxious, called her all sorts of things. When you're absolutely right. She was simply telling the truth, so she won't last long. But why do you need to have the media corralled into sycophancy and cronyism in order to do bad stuff? Why do you need Europe to be denigrated, undermined, and ideally silenced? Answer, in order to do bad stuff. So... it's not complicated if the dream is to be, and I can't go here yet. I don't know whether you can, Johnny. He wants to be a dictator?
Oh, I mean, it's the writing is on the wall as far as I'm concerned. You know, I think it's just they're going to try and shore themselves up for the midterms, try and maintain their majority, in government. And then I'll be very curious, you know, when 2028 comes along.
Yeah. What happens?
You know, yeah,
and of course, the troops, talking about the writing being on the wall, I know Simon Marks has expressed this fear, But putting troops who are clearly and signally not needed on the streets of American cities could be a precursor to claiming that things aren't safe enough to press ahead with midterms if he was worried enough or if it was clear enough that he was going to lose them on scale.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that the new White House press department directive of the, I don't know if you saw, they've now got a villain of the week. They put up a picture in the White House of a reporter that's written any disparaging piece about the government. That is, and I'm not trying to be overly dramatic, but that is the first step to where you are like, we are going to, you know, imprison journalists,
yes,
we are going to flog journalists, and God forbid we even are hanging journalists. And I'm not trying to be alarmist.
No, I know you're not. It's the Lurgan presser.
I just think that, and it is so, I will say, as you know, I moved to the States in 1995, kind of started coming back and forth in 2020, and then and left completely. And it is so sad to see where that country is headed. It's incredibly depressing.
And you know, to overuse that analogy, that as you've described it, they're not looking up. People aren't looking up and seeing the threat that is heading their way or the dangers that are heading their way. And, of course, one of the things I took away from a brilliant report by Jeremy Bowen on the BBC about the situation in Syria is that under hideous regimes, a lot of people are fine. They're better than fine. You know, a lot of, if you're on the right side of a hideous regime, your life can be great. It's very naive of us to sit here thinking everybody must have been opposed to Assad. Everybody must have been opposed to Hitler. Everybody must have been opposed even to Stalin. It's not true. It's why dystopian fiction is so powerful and so prevalent and so timeless. Because if you're in Parnem, you know, in the Hunger Games, you're laughing. So that is, I think, part of the jigsaw as well. But that question of why is he doing it? And what other answer is there? Because he dreams of being like the people that he's wooing, the people that he's kowtowing to, the people that he's craven in the presence of, the people that he's sucking up to. He dreams of being like them. Like what were the four countries that our first caller mentioned? Or Mike, I think it was, mentioned. Or Dave. It was India, China, Russia. He dreams of being like that. Dreams of that kind of role for himself on the world stage. So who's he going to hate? Well, the bigger you are on democracy, the bigger you are on transparency, the bigger you are on rules, the bigger you are on the rule of law, most obviously, the bigger you are on accountability, the bigger you are on human rights for your citizens, for your own citizens. Great way to attack human rights is by pretending it's all about the foreigners. But of course it's not. You get rid of human rights legislation, you lose human rights legislation. A bit like freedom of movement. You abolish freedom of movement because you had enough of Polish lorry drivers. Next thing you know, you can't stay at your house in France. For as long as you used to be able to. And your children can't do Erasmus and you can't move to other countries and work. You've abolished your own freedom of movement and Priti Patel's telling you to do a lap of honour. Oh, man, I'm still frightened of going there. Just professionally, not frightened emotionally. Saying that he clearly wants to be the kind of ruler that he most admires. A czar. A Putin. What other answer is there? Back to Occam's razor. Compromat. Self-enrichment. Or self-aggrandizement. Could be all three, could be a combination thereof, could be something else. 10:47 is the time.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
It's about the environment that you've been plopped into having been freshly minted at a university, and it just isn't working. And it's not working because you can't earn the money quick enough to go and start a life for yourself, so you're ditching it. And the YOLO kicks in, and you think, right, well, if someone's going to pay me to sit on my bum for a bit, I'm going to go travelling. Or if I've got the opportunity to go home with mum and dad and not pay any rent, I'm going to take that option for a bit and see where I am in 2 years' time.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
There's an old Thai saying that roughly translates as, the family who takes the internet on holiday can locate a less crowded beach. Particularly handy, my friend, if it's peak mating season for nippy little crabs. Pack the internet with an eSIM from Aerolo. That's A-I-R-A-L-O.
Ow. A Thames Link train is a place where you can wind down and catch up. A chance to let conversations flow and plans unfold. And swap doom-scrolling for telling stories too good for the group chat. Make the journey part of the joy and save 1/3 with off-peak group tickets at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
Take the world's best snooker players. One of the most unpredictable seasons. Add the electric atmosphere of Alexandra Palace. It can only be the 2026 Johnston's Paint Masters. Could it be Sean Murphy, Judd Trump, Neil Robertson, or world champion Zhaoxing Tong, who takes the trophy? One thing's certain. Nothing beats the Johnston's Paint Masters. Live. Enjoy our biggest ever fan zone. Watch in style from VIP sofas. Book now. WST.TV/tickets.
When it comes to retirement advice, the last thing you want is to be put in a bucket. Seen as this type of person or that type of person. At Fisher Investments UK, we never put you in a bucket. We always tailor retirement advice that's just right for you. Fisher Investments UK. Retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
Tonight's EuroMillions jackpot is £125 million.
It'll have you dancing like nobody is watching. Yeah, baby. Just make sure nobody is watching. Get in tonight's EuroMillions draw. Play on app.
Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last. Subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
10:50 is the time. I always get the giggles when I find myself poised to tell you that I think a lot about the 1930s, because I remember that trope from last year where men... Did it start on TikTok? I never understood it, about the number of times men think about the Roman Empire. I don't understand where that came from. I don't understand why it became a trope. I don't know what it was speaking to. I don't even know whether it was true, but for about 10 minutes, it was like 6-7. Everyone was talking about it, except they were much older than the usual 6-7ers. But I think about the 1930s a lot. I think about the 1930s more and more. When Chamberlain came back from Munich, were we cheering him? Were we like, oh, thank God for that, there's not going to be a war? We were, right? I mean, I hold in my hand a peace in our time. God, thank goodness for that. The memories of the First World War are still very fresh in the collective and the personal memory. Chamberlain comes back from a meeting with Hitler, and is persuaded, apparently, I think authentically and sincerely persuaded, that the fears they had about this character were unfounded and that his imperial ambitions had either already been realised or were nowhere near as violent as some commentators, most obviously Winston Churchill, spoiler alert for GCSE history students. We were all delighted, we were all looking the other way. So Churchill was writing at length about the obvious accumulation of force that Hitler was undertaking, and I don't know how much he wrote about the obvious attack upon democratic norms in Germany, but that's what I'm reminded of at the moment. One of Donald Trump's admirers, a co-founder of the data platform Palantir, has been calling for public hangings. So just in case you were responding to the last caller, worrying about, it was to Johnny in Battersea, spends a lot of time, has lived in the States, worrying about the demonization of journalists. Donald Trump, of course, recently broke bed with a man believed to have ordered the murder of a journalist, an American citizen, a dual citizen, a U.S. citizen, someone that historically the President of the United States would have been defending, but nothing about that. In fact, I think he criticised the journalist for asking about it. So this guy, Joe Lonsdale, calling for hangings to return, public hangings, mind, not just, you know, hangings in high security jails. Do you know why? Because he wants a return of, quotes, masculine leadership, end quotes. Anyone who uses the phrase masculine leadership when calling for more public hangings is, and this is a technical term, among the biggest girls' blouses on the planet. I mean, what an absolute... That was close. What an absolute wombat. I'm sure he spends an awful lot of time in the gym, but you know that he's a massive... we need public hangings to return masculine leadership. What do you think masculine leadership is? I'll give you a clue. Margaret Atwood, the author of A Handmaid's Tale, was interviewed at the weekend, and a brilliant interview by Lauren Laverne on Desert Island Discs, in which she revealed that she thinks the likelihood of that kind of misogynistic dystopia is greater than it has ever been in her own lifetime. And she wrote the literal book. She literally wrote the book. And now you've got one of Donald Trump's sort of pocket billionaires calling for public hangings and a return of, quotes, masculine leadership, end quotes. It's all going on. 10:54 is the time. Mark's in Brighton. Mark Riley, American radio veteran and great friend of this program. Mark, why is he doing it?
Hey, James, how you doing?
I'm good, Mark. I'm worried, but you know that already.
Well, yeah, and I just want to pose a couple of questions, because your last caller was really great.
Yeah, he was.
What do you think most Americans know the most about? Do they know the most about that national security strategy document? Do they know the most about the Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, Washington, Potomac, New Jersey, whatever? Yeah. Or do they know the most about the Sean Combs documentary that's just been aired?
Bread and circuses.
Yeah, absolutely. And people in the United States could give a crap about Ukraine, and Donald Trump knows it. And he wants to do business in Ukraine. His son is now laying the groundwork to do business in the Donbass to get some of those minerals.
So it's not about American interests. So when I say somewhat naively, why on earth does he need Putin to occupy the Donbass to do a deal? The United States government could do a much better deal, a more favorable deal with a sovereign Ukraine. But of course, if there's going to be deals that are not subject to transparency and legality, to rules and regulations, then he needs Putin to be in charge so that he can fill his own filthy boots, or his son's filthy boots.
Well, and see, here's the thing, James. The bottom line, and Putin knows this too, and I think Trump intuits this, at the rate things are going, and remember that the Russians largely are winning this war, what's going to end up happening, unless people are careful, is that Putin will end up, now he just said yesterday he wasn't going to give up any land.
Yeah.
Okay? He's eventually going to, if Trump has his way, he's going to end up being forced to give up that land. If he gives up that land, he will be deposed. Remember, you heard it here first.
Okay.
He will be deposed, and a much more Putin-friendly person will be put in charge of Ukraine. And that's the end game for all of these people.
Why attack Europe, then? I think I know the answer, but just in your words, why attack Europe? Why would this strategy document attack Europe and essentially amplify online racist lies about the country that we both live in?
Because they want to neutralize Europe. They want Europe not to be affected. Otherwise, why would he send Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, to the Soviet Union, to Russia, at the same time that he didn't have any Ukrainian, he certainly didn't have Zelensky, and he didn't have anybody from the States other than those guys. Trump didn't go. The bottom line is Trump wants a deal. He's a deal maker. He's a deal making president. And right now, the deal is he wants that land so his son can make money and so he can make money. I mean, he's 80 years old, but he still wants to make money.
Is there no historical grandiosity? I mean, but peace prizes aside, does he not want a kind of, I don't know quite what question I'm asking you, Mark, but the idea that he wants to go down in history as something big is a little bit more, it's more grandiose than mere greed, mere financial greed.
Well, look, he is right now in his own mind grandiose.
Right.
You got to understand, he already believes he's where you think he wants to be at. He wants it to be, if he had his way, he'd call it the United States of Trump.
Yeah, he would. Well, we know he's changing every... I mean, stuff, talk about the last caller pointing out that we're just worn down by it all. You'll know this, but the tradition in the United States has been for the national parks to provide free entry for everybody on Martin Luther King Day. He's just abolished that and replaced it with his own birthday.
Of course. Absolutely. It's all part of... This is why he hates Keir Starmer, because to him, it's more important to talk to King Charles than it ever will be to Keir Starmer. He he doesn't have a problem under certain circumstances with dealing with parts of Europe, of Europe that align with his views.
Which is why this document talks about the far right parties as allies, essentially, in a European future.
Yeah, because as far as he's concerned, the European future doesn't include a great deal of influence.
I just lost the line there. I think, you know, the Russians, the I think was the word that we lost. But I'm moving on partly because I've actually hit the news on time, but also because the phone line was disintegrating as we spoke. It is an extraordinary moment. And, I'm fascinated by the UK media because it's all I ever wanted to do as a kid. My father was a journalist and I followed him into the profession. But how on earth we can be marking a moment in which our staunchest and oldest ally, militarily, let alone politically, is essentially denigrating and demeaning us while delighting and cozying up to our enemies. The murderous dictator Vladimir Putin delighted with this national security strategy, every democratically elected leader in Europe disgusted by it, and the UK media is largely ignoring it.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, rail services, flights and ferries are facing disruption as Storm Bram moves across the British Isles. Large parts of the UK are covered by Met Office yellow alerts, with more severe amber warnings in the far northwest. More than 70 flood warnings are in place. LBC's Alan Zizinski says parts of Scotland are braced for extreme conditions.
The transport operators have been advising customers not to travel in those hotspot areas, the northwest of the country, where we have that amber danger to life warning in place from 4 p.m. And that is where we are expecting gusts of up to 90 miles an hour.
Stay with LBC and the LBC app for the latest. The peer leading an investigation into maternity care failings in England has insisted it will deliver change. Baroness Amos, who is leading the National Maternity and Neonatal Investigation, says the situation is much worse than she expected. Campaigners say her recommendations must be implemented when they're published next year. Two men have been charged in connection with a robbery at Heathrow Airport. More than 20 people were hit with pepper spray in a multi-storey car park at Terminal 3 on Sunday. Tyrone Richards and Anton Clark Butcher, who are 31 and 24, are accused of robbery and administering a noxious substance. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has promised to carry out a full review of the UK's welfare system. She says the government needs to draw a line on the health issues that make people eligible for benefits. Ms. Badenoch insisted every single person who can work should work.
We have 1 million more people claiming universal credit since last year's budget. Not since the election, since last year's budget. 1 million more people are on universal credit. They could have done something about this. They could have changed course. They could have backed business, brought taxes down. But instead, they taxed hard-working people to pay for benefits.
Ministers have made a series of announcements in recent days on supporting young people into work. The world's first social media ban for children is about to take effect in Australia. Platforms including Instagram, TikTok and YouTube will be off-limits to under-16s from 1 o'clock UK time. They've been forced to block more than 1 million accounts. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 96.55. That's up 10. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 14. LBC weather, wet and windy for most parts of the country as the storm moves in. The most severe conditions in the far northwest. A high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
After some wonderful wine for Christmas, try our wine of the week, the Tesco Finest Chablis. Chosen by our master of wine, Beth, this refreshing white will pair perfectly with your roast turkey centrepiece. And right now, you can pick up a bottle for £10 with your club card. Tesco, every little helps. Drinkware 18 plus ends 15th of December. Club card or app required. Available in majority of larger stores and online. Excludes Express and Whoosh.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 3 minutes after 11. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Thank you for that. And it was, I found it really helpful, really illuminating and really interesting. And I would have done so if I was sitting in the bath listening rather than having to marshal the entire conversation, but not for the first time. The quality of contributors warmed the cockles of my aging heart. Speaking of aging, we'll turn your attention next to the other end of the generational scale, to people under 16 on the other side of the world. Who's your target for the next hour? People under 16 on the other side of the world. Because I think while we're on air, I'm always a little bit, what's the word that I want? A little bit unclear on the time difference between the UK and Australia. But I think that while we're on air, then technically midnight will be reached in parts of Australia, which means the social media ban on under 16s will kick in. Can anyone do the sums for me and give me exactly the details that I need? I'm crowdsourcing now. My team are busy. Doing what? I'm not entirely sure, but they're very busy, always very busy. It's going to kick in. A couple of other stories around today that speak to similar territory, or that lead us into similar territory. Yvette Cooper is due to give a speech in which she will call upon Britain and Europe to fight back against escalating attacks by Russia and other hostile states. This is online. This is the cyber army. I'll tell you what, if anyone in the UK media is more entitled to a little bit of I told you so cake than me, it's Carol Cadwalader, now, of course, running a new organisation called The Nerve, which I heartily recommend for brilliant journalism, and also because it's Stuart Lee's new home. Stuart, by some distance, the finest columnist currently working in the English language. But the a simple statement that Carol was making some years ago about the war has already started. We are already at war. Yvette Cooper will take it up today. You could say better late than never. Not just cyber, of course, but across Europe, she writes, or she will say, we are witnessing an escalation in hybrid threats from physical through to cyber, designed to weaken critical national infrastructure, undermine our interests, and interfere in our democracies, all for the advantage of malign foreign states. And to tie that in with the last hour of this program, the US is now on the side of the malign foreign state and is attacking Europe, even as it comes under attack, both physical and cyber, from Vladimir Putin's Russia. So that speaks to the dangers of social media. There's a horrible story, an actually heartbreaking story, about teenagers turning to AI chatbots for mental health support. It's not necessarily or immediately a bad thing, but we have spoken to the mother, haven't we, of a young man who took his own life after essentially feeling that the AI chatbot that he was in almost constant conversation with had become a trustworthy friend. There is another story a little bit like that accompanying another story in the news today about children being, or young people being almost encouraged. Well, actually, yeah, not even almost, being encouraged into doing the worst imaginable thing to themselves by AI, by chatbots. And the people responsible for it kind of wash their hands. It's a bit like, it's a variation on the theme of social media platforms not being publishers. You know, you create something and you unleash it into the world and you have no responsibility for it. Is that new? I know it took a while, but nobody ever thought that tobacconists weren't responsible for tobacco. That nobody ever thought that fossil fuel companies weren't responsible for fossil fuels. Sure, they argued and lied about the negative impacts of those things in order to protect their income streams, but they never tried to pretend that they weren't somehow responsible for it. Did they? Maybe they did. It's not my fault you're an addict. Loads of people aren't addicts, and they use my products perfectly happily, so I can't be held responsible. But even there, there's you know, a breakdown. Everybody is responsible for their actions, except this new generation of billionaire, except these tech bros who own platforms, and latterly the ones that are unleashing AI upon an unprepared population. So more than 53% of teenagers said they had used some form of online mental health support in the past year. That's fine. That might just mean accessing a website run by a mental health charity. But 25% have used AI chatbots. Again, it's not by definition a bad thing to be doing, but it's unsupervised usually and therefore quite worrying. So, couple of stories there that give you an idea of the broader ramifications of an unpoliced, a Wild West social media that is still unregulated and still furiously defended by the people making billions of pounds from it. But the Australian government is pushing back. The Australian government is making a stand. And it will start, I think, while we are on air. If not, very, very shortly afterwards. So 12 noon UK time is 4 a.m. next Wednesday in Australia. So I think we may... Is that correct? I don't know. I probably should have checked that before reading it. Also, it's not the most important element of this conversation. Don't ring me to tell me what time it is in Australia. But I think it's kicking in while we're on air. And I don't know what to think about it. Well, I do know what to think about it. I think it's an absolutely brilliant idea. As in theory, I think it's absolutely wonderful. But in practice, does it actually matter whether it works or not? How many times in life have you encouraged perhaps your children or perhaps your parents encouraged you to look back and know that you did your best? Even if it didn't work, you did your best. And this seems to me to be not a desperate roll of the dice by the Australian government, but a very rare example of, and I'm going to call Australia a Western democracy, which may not be geographically accurate, but you know what I mean by that. The kind of country that Donald Trump hates, as opposed to dictatorships and plutocracies or oligarchies. They are doing something about it. They are doing something about it. They are literally saying to everybody in Australia under the age of 16 that you are no longer allowed onto these platforms. You are no longer allowed onto social media platforms. Some of them have ostensible age limits already, but everybody knows that they are almost entirely meaningless and pointless. Teenagers, particularly being targeted by these incredibly wealthy global firms, will have to prove their age in order to get online. Now, I fully recognize that VPNs and various other things are going to provide ways in which people can bypass the laws or get round the regulations. And that is relevant to the conversation that we're about to have, because if the loopholes are so huge that they end up undermining or destroying the whole project, then that is relevant. And that is a tragedy, I think. But the real question here is why this is such a good idea. I think we may have just veered a little bit too far into the, well, it's not going to work, so there's no point doing it. And we will do that this hour. I don't think it's true, by the way. I think with the age limits on pornography sites, we've seen that, yes, some people will sideline or bypass the regulations that are in place, but actually, I bet that they're working when it comes to keeping people under 18 off these sites, even if some people over 18 who don't want to have to fill in their details in order to access their pornography have paid for a VPN or paid to get past the gatekeepers. I don't think it is time yet to say that it's doomed, if you see what I mean. And other people are watching very closely. The state of Utah in the United States has experimented with this. European Union countries have experimented with this. But Australia is rewriting the rule book. Australia is going all in on a ban, a full ban for under 16s that kicks in UK time tomorrow. They have shouted and keened and whined and moaned about the law, the big firms, the big social media firms. All they are required to do is take reasonable steps to keep underage users from having accounts on their platforms. They've argued that it makes children less safe, that it impinges on their rights. Some teenagers have come out to complain a little bit more rationally, perhaps, than the people making a ton of money out of teenagers' mental anguish and susceptibility to advertising. Questions around the tech remain about how the policy will be enforced. We're not entirely sure, but I love it. I absolutely love it. Because here's the thing. It creates an unassailable position in which children going on social media is a bad thing that should be resisted. Now, not every child in the country brushes their teeth, but we live in a country where we know that children should brush their teeth every morning and every night. And just because children can somehow not brush their teeth or can get away with not brushing their teeth doesn't change the central societal foundation that brushing your teeth is a good thing. This isn't the best analogy I've ever come up with. In fact, I've got very little idea where it came from. Sometimes I open my mouth and I'm more surprised than you are by what comes out. But that essential societal foundation, social media is a bad thing for under 16s. A net bad, okay? So, yes, there will be examples of it being good. And, yes, there will be reasons why a blanket ban is suboptimal. But that's the only choice you've got. You've got a choice between a free-for-all or an attempted ban. And I cannot think of any piece of legislation, particularly in a foreign country, in recent years that is as bold and as brave as this. Because it is essentially saying, yeah, we can get the genie back into the bottle. And if we can't, then we're going to die trying. Because what this technology does to our young people is hideous, harrowing, and obviously wrong. The key point for me, and I'm guilty of not looking up on some of this stuff, but the key point for me was that documentary, the name of which temporarily eludes me, but you will remind me very, very shortly, when a lot of the big Silicon Valley heavy hitters explained to documentary makers that they wouldn't let their own children anywhere near the technology that their fortunes were built upon. A lot of the big social media platform architects and owners absolutely adamant that they would no sooner let their six-year-old smoke than let them have access to the platforms from which they derived their fortunes. Nobody knew better what the risks were than the people who built it. And they almost all concluded that they wouldn't let their own children anywhere near it. Well, I mean, what better advertisement could there be? What bigger endorsement could there be of the idea that it does our children harm? And God knows, it does us harm. It does us harm. You're never going to be able to ban it for adults. You're never going to be able to get that particular genie back in the bottle. But we've had age limits on all sorts of things throughout history. Right up to and including the present day, there are age limits on smoking. They don't stop people underage from smoking, but they obviously work. There are age limits on alcohol. There are age limits on driving. There are age limits on getting married. There are age limits on all sorts of things. And they work. They massively reduce the risk to minors. And therefore, I am absolutely hoping that this one kicks in. 11:16 is the time. Here's the question. I think I'm going to get this right. We may change the question slightly if it doesn't land right with you. But I want you to just have a little think. And remember now, in 2025, there are people listening who were in the first wave of childhood access to social media. I rarely feel older than when I explain to my children about things like CDs and search engines. Growing up in a world without streaming, where you literally can listen to every album that has ever been made at the flick of a switch, at the press of a button. Imagine explaining that to your 15-year-old self if you were my age. I used to wash next door's car so that I could borrow his tapes and stick them through my Matsui tape-to-tape hi-fi and record the tapes that he had paid, £7-8 for. With his permission, by the way, I want to make that clear. The idea, and you'd listen to stuff you didn't even like that much because you had it on tape. And then the idea of search engines being an AI being able to provide you with, we've got no idea what it would have been like to grow up with access to social media. It boils adults' brains. We've all watched people go utterly nuts down rabbit holes about vaccines or white supremacism. Look what it's done to adults and tell me that it's a bad idea to ban children from it. It's insanely obvious that it is the right thing to do. But I think we could begin today with why you do or don't like this idea. Not why you do or don't think it's going to work, but let's just begin. I'm going to take a lot of persuading from the position that I'm in, but why you love or hate, why you like or don't like a ban, the Australia attempted ban on social media access for all under 16s. All right? That's all I want from you, why you like it or don't like it. Hit the numbers now, you will get through. 0345 6060 973. You've got an image of King Canute trying to turn back the tide, but what if it worked? Or what if you saved 50% of young people from the toxic influence of these platforms? 40%, 60%, 80%. What possible argument can there be against trying to give children their childhood back? If you've got it, I want to hear it. And if, like me, you think it's a brilliant idea, I want you to tell me why. Ideally, with a little bit of reference to your own life. I am a survivor of teenage social media access, James, and I can tell you just how much harm it can do to a person. Tell me about yourself. Tell me about your little brother, your little sister. Tell me about what social media does to young minds that old minds are still a little bit too slow on the uptake to fully appreciate. Okay? 0345 6060 973 is the number you need. And listen, if you've got objections, then in many ways you're doubly welcome, because I know what my opinions are. I'd love to know why you don't share them. It's 11:19.
The new LBC app. News your way. This is LBC.
With Lloyd's Home Insurance, there's £50,000 to be won. When you cover the glassware, no one's actually allowed to use. Or the garden shed, a.k.a. your fortress of calm. Rated excellent on Trustpilot, you can be confident with your cover when you take out a new home insurance policy and be in for a chance to win £50,000. Get a quote with Lloyds today. Buy a new home insurance policy direct from us by the 31st of December 2025. Offer T's and C's apply. Policy terms, limits and exclusions apply.
Do you have a co-op card or membership number? In July, Co-op's CEO confirmed that the personal data of all 6.5 million members was accessed in a major cyber attack. If you're a member, your information may have been exposed, and you could be entitled to compensation through a group action claim. Check your eligibility today at jointheclaim.com. It's quick, secure, and easy to do online at jointheclaim.com.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
Unwrap daily surprises this December with the Little Plus Advent Calendar. Every day until Christmas, you could get exclusive offers like money off coupons and even the chance to win a year's free shopping. Check the Little Plus app every day to open 24 missable offers. Lidl, more to value.
18 plus GB only, while stocks last. Minimum spend required. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Biggest lesson. I'm doing a podcast later with those splendid people at Oh God, What Now? And it's like a review of the year, of the big stories and what are the most important things. But I often sit here talking to you, or talking at you perhaps some mornings, thinking about the big takeaways, the big learns, the big lessons that we've had together. And some of them are really obvious, but you need them to be pointed out for them to land properly. And I think that the biggest one of all is the fact that these people will never do anything unless they have to. They just won't. It doesn't matter what it is they're selling, whether it's fizzy drinks or gambling or cigarettes or diesel fuel or alcohol, or they will never do anything unless they have to. Or payday loans with usurious rates of interest. They will never do anything unless they have to. They will never do anything because it's for the good of the species, let alone the good of the planet. I don't think this is a particularly sparkling insight. It's possibly suicidally naive to think otherwise. E-numbers, food regulations, fossil fuels, they will, if they're making a buck out of it, they will never do anything that reduces the amount of buck they make unless they absolutely have to. You sit here having ludicrous, hand-wringing conversations about waiting for social media platforms to act responsibly. And you know what they'll do? They'll announce something, or they'll fund a tiny little organisation called Social Media Acting Responsibly. And they'll hire some ex-politician to front it up and appear on programmes arguing against more regulation. Or they'll just bung a ton of money to some Herbert on Tufton Street working for a ludicrous lobby group pretending it's a think tank and coming up with mad names that make them sound academic, and they appear in every newspaper and every program under the sun. And you say, what do you exist to do? They never say, we're here to make sure that none of the people making lots of money have to make a little bit less money in order to protect our children, in order to protect our planet, in order to protect our species. Cigarettes, fossil fuels, sugar, fizzy drinks, sweets, e-numbers, additives. I could go on forever. They're never, ever, ever, not only are they never going to do anything voluntarily, they are going to fight like ferrets in a sack against having to do something compulsorily. Young people's access to social media platforms is toxic. You might as well give them all a little vial of poison every morning and invite them to ingest it. But if someone's making a ton of money out of the poison, they're going to fight tooth and nail to resist regulation of it. So how can you not like a ban on social media for under 16s? Good luck, Australia, and all who sail in her. Matt's in Waltham Forest. Matt, what would you like to say?
Morning, James. second time in about 2 weeks that we've spoken. I spoke to you about universal credit previously.
Yeah.
So obviously, yeah, it's a great idea. And I sort of come at this from, again, my own, you know, I don't know if you remember, but I said I was a journalist back in the day.
Yes, of course.
My experience with this whole platform versus publisher stuff goes back to about 2008. I was the managing editor of a website you might be familiar with called politics.co.uk.
Oh, yes.
Worked with Ian Dunn, I think. You know, we've got a mutual friend there.
Lovely. And
we used to provide Yahoo with a bit of content. And I remember having a meeting with Yahoo and getting quite concerned about some of the comments underneath the sort of analysis or opinion pieces that we were giving them.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I ever heard them say, oh, yeah, well, we're not really responsible for that. We're not going to censor any of that because we're a platform, we're not a publisher. And that set off alarm bells for me. And as I sort of then went through my career, it continued on and continued on. It's like, you know, we're platforms, we're not responsible. So when we get to the online safety bill, I end up as part of a campaign group trying to get fraud back into the bill as a priority harm because it had been taken out by the government.
Right.
You know, about 17 organisations all got together. And one of the things we went after was paid for advertising because this is one of the ways that fraudsters get to their victims. So we sort of went after them and said, look, you've got to put fraud back in the bill, but you've also got to make Google, Facebook, et cetera, responsible for actually monitoring the adverts that are coming onto their websites because they're not doing it properly, because this is how the fraudsters
Martin Lewis gets incredibly exercised about fraudsters using his image and his reputation
One of the campaign group members was Money and Mental Health Policy Institute, which is his charity.
Indeed.
So I was kind of working with him at arm's length kind of thing on this stuff as well. But at the point the reason why we went after the advertising and then went after the user-generated content elements was to change the argument so that they couldn't then turn around and say that they were platforms. They had to now be publishers. There is a duty of care now in the Online Safety Act that actually means that they have to take responsibility for their user-generated content and for the advertising. Now, that hasn't really kicked in yet, because the Act is so big and so unwieldy that there's still a lot of statutory instruments going through Parliament at the moment that are then designed to give Ofcom the power that it needs to go after.
I wonder how relevant some of what you're telling us is to the conversation we had in the last hour about attacks on Europe from America and from...
100%.
Because that's what they're worried about, is having their platforms regulated.
Europe's been looking at it for a little while. Australia led the way on this. We then ended up following in the UK, and I think what they're worried about in the US is that Europe is going to do the same thing.
And it will cost... They'll still be the richest people in the world, but they won't be as rich as they were before the legislation came in.
No.
That's the bit we can't get our heads around as ordinary Joes, isn't it? You'll still be the richest people in the world, lads. Calm down. Yeah, but I won't be as rich as I could have been.
Also, you said this... One thing you said just before I came on, right, they won't do anything unless they're forced to.
Yeah.
It's 100% true. Now, when it looked like we were winning the argument over advertising and user-generated content, Facebook, Google, etc., came out, I think it was the summer of 22, maybe, and announced that they were voluntarily going to start looking after, going to start monitoring this stuff. And we're like, so hold on, you weren't going to do it beforehand, but now that there's a...
And here's Nick Clegg to oversee it. Here's Nick Clegg to oversee it. There you go. I said a retired politician, didn't I? They'll be put in charge of it all.
There was another clause within the Act for which pot were found, and that we ended up having to go after, because it was originally going to be a three-tier system. So depending on the size of social media platform, etc., you had to follow certain rules, and it would have been up to the Home Secretary to decide which tier that you fell into. Now, you can imagine the size of
fighting furiously.
Facebook. Google and Facebook's lobbying machine would have put them in tier B straight away. So we turned around and said, no, there's got to be a level playing field for absolutely everybody. And eventually it was amended so that that didn't, so that that was the case.
So this is what the average punter, myself included, doesn't really understand. I mean, I use the word lobbyist and I throw it around and I have very little... I have nothing but contempt for the people who pretend they work for think tanks, but who are lobbyists for precisely the interests that we're talking about. But they exist for a reason, and they exist to resist furiously, passionately, deeply dishonestly any attempts to regulate the industries that deliver them huge profits. And they would be aiming to water down almost every element of the Online Safety Act that currently allows money to be made. I don't want to be late for the news, but I already am. But I want to ask you one more question.
Sure.
Which is about the plausibility. This is only going to be the second question for every caller. I don't want the phone in to be about the plausibility of it. But how big a deal is it? How big an issue is the plausibility of what Australia is doing right now, today?
It is entirely within the capabilities, I believe, of Facebook and the like to... stop under 16s from accessing their content and accessing their websites. I mean, if they can do it for, porn websites, they've already got age verification.
Or gambling, most obviously, gambling websites.
Gambling
as well,
right? So if you've got those kind of, if you can put in age verification for that, I don't see why you can't do it for, the under 16s. And frankly, I would never want I've had long conversations. My son turned 13 yesterday, my eldest, he knows full well not to go near that stuff.
Are you sure?
I did use that. We've had so many conversations about it, and I used that whole thing about the CEOs of Facebook, etc.
Social Dilemma, that film was called, wasn't it? The Social Dilemma, where all of the people making all the money out of it don't let their own children anywhere near it.
Yeah, I've been very, me and my ex-wife have been really, really monitoring this stuff really carefully. I've literally just said to them that don't, it'll rot your brain kind of thing.
Yeah.
I've even talked to the boys about sort of adolescence and, I let them watch the first episode because it was so powerful.
But for children whose parents aren't on the ball, which is going to be most parents, this is literally heaven sent. Or not literally heaven sent.
The thing is, I don't think parents, you think about how busy they are, how much time do they actually have to be monitoring their kids' phones all the time or what they're doing online. I know what my two do. They're mostly on YouTube watching silly stuff like Mr. Beast or whatever. It's fine. But that doesn't mean that, over the next couple of years, particularly...
That's the challenge. It moves the goalposts, actually, in a good way. It literally moves the baseline. It moves the foundation point. Everybody's going to be on social media, or at least everyone's going to have access to social media, but make it harder and later. And it can only be a good thing. I'd ban it for adults. I know that sounds daft, but I'd ban it for adults as well. I think those early days, like glory days of it being this wonderful tool, like almost the whole of the internet, a wonderful tool for illumination and education and edification and lots of other Asians. Almost in the blink of an eye, it turned into an absolute sewer where reality itself, the truth itself is under constant threat on social media. In particular, but you find a nice corner and you stay there until the racists arrive, and then you'll have to up sticks, pack your tent, and move on to somewhere else. Twitter, I don't know why anyone. I heard a BBC presenter, one of my favourite BBC presenters, give out their Twitter address on air the other day, and I thought, that's odd, isn't it? Because you're advertising a money-making organisation there, and you are commoditised. You are going to make money for Elon Musk by driving people towards your own account on social media. And you're still doing it, even after he's been filmed doing Nazi salutes, even after he's made his own commitment to white supremacism clear, even after he spreads lies from the likes of Stephen Yaxley Lennon. Not only are you still there as an organisation, but you're still there as an individual. You're still there giving out your Twitter address on on air, on the BBC, on a licence payer-funded platform. Sheesh. A little more, perhaps. Thank you for that, Matt. Brilliant stuff. On the question of why you personally welcome it, because you know the damage it can do. Thomas Watts is here with your headlines.
The government has been urged to name the army's top spy inside the IRA during the Troubles. A newly published report says Steak Knife committed grotesque, serious crime, including torture and murder. Danger to life warnings are due to come into force as Storm Bram moves across the UK. There are already delays and cancellations affecting rail services, flights and ferries. Two men have been charged in connection with a robbery at Heathrow Airport. More than 20 people were hit with pepper spray in a multi-storey car park at Terminal 3 on Sunday. LBC weather, wet and windy across much of the country. The most severe conditions in the northwest, a high of 15 degrees.
This is LBC.
Think about cheese. Make your thoughts cheesier. Now add 100% chicken breast fillet, chipotle sauce and a mega cheese melt. And it's giving the new cheesy chicken stack at McDonald's. Did we mention it's cheesy?
Cheese.
Available until the 4th of Jan 2026 from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
When it comes to retirement advice, the last thing you want is to be put in a bucket. Seen as this type of person or that type of person. At Fisher Investments UK, we never put you in a bucket. We always tailor retirement advice that's just right for you. Fisher Investments UK. Retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
They did it again. Flour instead of flowers. On my birthday. I'm 95 minutes late. But it's hard to leave when you've shared so much. Your postcode. Your gluten intolerance. Then I saw it. 25% off your first Ocado shop. Plus free delivery. And I just knew I'd found the online supermarket of my dreams. Ocado. Life delivered. Geographical restrictions. Min spend £60. Max saving £20. Charges and Christmas restrictions apply. New customers only. Terms at Ocado.com.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Stop upon island fuel. R. Rest every 2 hours to I. Inspect tire pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with
T-R-I-P. Think. Do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
This might sound a little bit odd, but I think that one of the best illustrations of just how bonkers you can be sent by social media is provided by a former UK Prime Minister. I genuinely do. I'm not being funny. And in fact, Clement has picked up on this, sending a message to 84850, saying, James, I love you, which for new listeners is the best way of getting a critical message read out. You don't have to put that on nice messages. This isn't really critical. I love you, but, and then I'll probably read it, you see. I love you, but I am a bit sad you haven't yet talked about the Liz Truss show on YouTube. Funny you should say that, Clement.
But this show is not just doom and gloom.
Pardon? What was the introduction there? I must have missed it. I thought we had the ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the home of the counter-revolution. Welcome to the Liz Truss show. I shall consult my archive shortly, but if you have paid even lip service to the latest attempt by Liz Truss to both insulate herself from the criticisms that she so richly deserves and recreate an alternative reality, I think she's indicative of what can happen when you live your entire life online. And I've got more treats from this broadcast for you in the course of this hour. But the bigger question of the moment, the more important question of the moment, is about the Australian ban on social media for all under 16s. And I honestly, I genuinely, hand on heart, do not know what's not to like. It just seems to me that the only position from which we might approach it in a negative way would be because we've been slightly conditioned and brainwashed by the lobbyists, by the big tech lobbyists who will resist any attempt to dilute in any way, shape or form the amount of money they make from spreading hatred, anxiety, mental health problems and all the other issues that young people are exposed to on social media. And how do we know that? Because old people are as well. Tim's in Cardiff. Tim, what made you pick up the phone?
Morning, James. I'm calling from the point of view of a parent of a couple of teenagers. So firstly, I think it's a fabulous idea.
Someone not? Are we going to have to speculate? I'm just looking at my screen to see if I've got anyone coming on to be opposed to it. But how could you not like it? So I really want my children to be on these hideous platforms.
But I wonder if other parents think the same way that I do. So it's been an experience of gradually wearing away. And fair play to your previous caller who said that he's stopping his 13-year-old son from going onto social media. But my son started with, can I go on Snapchat? That's where all my friends are so I can chat to them. And obviously then Snapchat serves up content as well. So then he gets into, you know, that thing where he starts seeing videos and then it becomes, can I go on Instagram? Can I go on TikTok? All my friends are on it. And, you know, as a parent, I gradually was worn away. I do monitor what he looks at. And
well,
I
you try
sure
you try to monitor what he looks
I
at.
I try to monitor, yeah.
15's and, a tough age, isn't it? I mean, we were all doing things at
really
15
is.
That our parents knew nothing about.
Well, absolutely. And I suppose this brings in your whole plausibility argument as well, which I'm sure we'll get on to. But in terms of why, for me, from a more selfish point of view, why I think it's a good idea, is it takes the burden off us as parents a little bit, because if you don't have the peer group all on it, then
point.
That argument of, but all of my friends are on it, goes away, and I don't have to be the bad guy that says, no, you cannot go on social media. Someone's taken that away from me.
Yeah. And I mean, what else? I'm trying to think, what did we claim as kids that everyone was doing and we weren't allowed to? I mean, bedtime was the most obvious one, wasn't it?
Everyone, I remember. But I suppose that there was always the scare stories about computer games as well, making us into, you know, awful, violent people as we were, you know, shooting stuff.
And if no one had been allowed, there's always one kid in the class who was allowed to do things that nobody else was allowed to do, and we all thought he was the bee's knees. But you're right, it does take away all of that peer pressure. I mean, the platforms that are going to be affected are Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Threads, TikTok, X, all affected. YouTube Kids won't be, but YouTube Adult will. Reddit, Kick, and Twitch. I mean, one thing we might move on to is the hole it's going to leave in young people's lives. And I don't say that as a caution against the legislation. I love the legislation, but there's going to be some 15-year-olds who, that's 4 or 5 hours of their day disappearing in the blink of an eye, right?
But surely that's a good thing.
Of course, it's
right?
a good
thing. They're not going to leave that hole there unfilled. They will find something to do with that. I mean, hopefully it won't increase the time spent playing, I don't know, Fortnite or whatever it is.
But, you're going to have, I mean, that is it, isn't it? From a parent's point of view, what you want is somebody else to do the heavy lifting. And the best possible way of doing that is to remove the peer pressure. And the plausibility, I think, is a bit of a red herring. I think that the plausibility is a bit of a red herring, because as we've established, you've done it in other areas. They've done it with pornography. They've done it with gambling. They've done it in other kind of platforms. And so you are simply saying, prove to me you're over 16 or stay off this platform. And I know that they've got the technology and the capability to do it. And therefore, the only question, why haven't they done it themselves, is the easiest one to answer, because they're making too much money out of it. And just in case anybody, anywhere, is under the illusion that spending too much time on, for example, YouTube can boil your brains, anyone thinks it cannot boil your brains, here is a warning for us all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the home of the counter-revolution. Welcome to the Liz Truss Show.
Oh, boy. The way she says the last bit is just yet more evidence or grist to the mill of wondering whether she is on a massive grift, a hideous, failing grift, and her soul is withering inside every time she opens her mouth in public, or whether she is so far down the rabbit hole of her own delusion that she actually thinks she is leading some sort of counter-revolution. I have no idea, but it's as if she wrote down all the unhinged headlines that we've done on this program over the last couple of years and ate them. I literally sprinkled them with a little bit of salt and vinegar and ate them all. Everywhere I look, I've only got 10 clips for you, and every single one is essentially either an unhinged headline or, oh, this is probably my favourite, or the first sentence of an unhinged article. Just check this one out.
Despite the valiant efforts of a certain Prime Minister to get things on the right track in 2022, this country seems to have a death wish.
I mean, we wondered in the last hour who on earth Donald Trump is aiming for, what on earth the purpose of his foreign policy statement is. Liz Truss seems to be on a very similar page. Who on earth is going to watch this programme? Is she just trying to frighten Americans? Or is it serving some other currently mysterious purpose? I do not know. Luma is in Orpington. Luma, what would you like to say?
Thanks for having me on, James.
You're very welcome.
And sorry for being the one who says I actually don't think this is a good idea.
That's right. I'm going to tear you to shreds and spit out the pips.
It's very hard to find something where you don't agree, James.
Go on then. But tell me more.
It's basic human psychology. It becomes a forbidden, and we're all programmed to want to go after the forbidden. It becomes a bit of a challenge. How can I get on it? Because again, the children who are now like even 8 or 9, not even 16, they are aware of the technology. They are aware of these platforms. It's been very, very attractive for a very long period of time. And suddenly you're telling them, no, you can't go there. And they'll find every possible way of getting on there.
Well, that's just defeatist. I mean, you could say that about anything. But why do we ban cigarettes for under 16s? Why do we ban alcohol for under 18s? So some people will get hold of it.
Right. You're absolutely right. But then the other point, besides the fact that it will become more attractive, is the fact that you really want a 16-year-old high on adulthood and hormones to discover social media at that age without having been prepared or understand how to do it safely.
Why do you think they won't be prepared? Or why do you think they won't be better prepared than ever before? I mean, the two will go hand in hand.
You're assuming that there's not a lot of details about what exactly beside this ban, which I think should already have happened or will happen in the next 20 minutes, actually translates into.
Yes,
but your last caller made a point of, like, it reduces the burden on parents. Unfortunately, no. This ultimately boils down into us as parents deciding how do we want to introduce our children to safe ways to use the technology.
I did warn you I was going to spit out the pits, but this is a completely meaningless argument because at the moment we're dropping 8-year-olds from a great height into the middle of unregulated social media. We're dropping 10-year-olds. We're dropping 11-year-olds. So saying, oh, I'm very worried about dropping 16-year-olds from a great height into the middle of social media is palpably absurd. What is the best age to be dropped into the middle of social media? 8, 11, 16 or 30?
To be honest?
Yeah.
Earlier, with proper guidance is better.
No. Proper guidance is available at every single one of those ages. We're talking about the world we live in. I'm very worried about what would happen to 16-year-olds if they're suddenly exposed to social media, and that's why we should carry on suddenly exposing 8-year-olds to social media, is, you must realise now, a completely ridiculous position.
How old are your children, James?
19 and 17. Yes.
So I like the pose. I love the fact that you chose that.
You know about birthdays.
Yes, I know. So my little one is going to be 5 early next year.
Yeah.
I appreciate that she's going to grow in a world which is very different to the one I grew up in. And the one that...
I'm going to steer you back. I'm just looking at the time. Yeah, I'm going to steer you back to the point I made and the argument you're making, which is I'm very worried about dropping 16-year-olds into the middle of social media unprepared, so therefore we must carry on dropping 9-year-olds into it unprepared. That's your argument.
Two arguments. A, the fact that it's banned so it becomes more attractive.
No, that's not the argument I'm addressing. I'm addressing your claim that it's so worrying about 16-year-olds that we should carry on doing it to 9-year-olds.
So the difference with the 16-year-old is that they are going through adulthood. You have hormones, which you don't have at 18.
Right.
That will drive very different set of behavior. Again, you can argue with me,
15, 14, 13, 12, but you're never, and I think deep down we both know it, you cannot argue that we shouldn't do something to 16-year-olds because it might be damaging or dangerous, but therefore we must carry on doing it to 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds. I don't know when the hormones appear that you mention on this scale, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds, 14-and-a-half-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 15-and-a-half-year-olds, 15-and-three-quarters-year-olds. So let's carry on, leave them to it. Let them fend for themselves. But my goodness me, we must protect the 16-year-olds and the 17-year-olds. It just doesn't, you know it doesn't work. I know it doesn't work. Everybody listening knows it doesn't work. But thank you for playing.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
They come here because they know it's a soft touch.
Straight to the point.
How does this even add up?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
This is a Whitehall farce without any doubt.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
A Thameslink train is a place where family moments become more peaceful. Where you can spread out and a game of I Spy gets a scenic upgrade with snacks, stories and the occasional sheep for a bonus point. Less stress, more yes, with kids' tickets for £2 at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
They did it again. Flour instead of flowers. On my birthday. I'm 95 minutes late. But it's hard to leave when you've shared so much. Your postcode, your gluten intolerance. Then I saw it. 25% off your first Ocado shop. Plus, free delivery. And I just knew I'd found the online supermarket of my dreams. Ocado. Life delivered. Geographical restrictions. Min spend £60. Max saving £20. Charges and Christmas restrictions apply. New customers only. Terms at Ocado.com.
A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Drop up on island fuel. R. Rest every 2 hours to I inspect tire pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P. A safe trip begins with T-R-I-P.
Think. Do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
At Fidelity, we've been helping our customers plan for their retirements for nearly 20 years. From understanding how much you'll need to combining multiple pensions, we offer expert insights, excellent service, and even financial advice, so you can feel confidently invested in your future. For pensions, advice, or investment accounts, be invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Transferring is not right for everyone. Terms apply.
Serious about the right vitamins for you and your family? Trust Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company, for expert nutritional care for every age and lifestyle. Vitamins for everyone, including Well Man, Well Woman, Well Baby and Well Kid. From Boots, Pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see Vitabiotics.com.
While all the Whos of Whoville were at McDonald's eating, the Grinch from his lair started plotting and scheming. Gherkin-flavoured fries and odd socks will send them crackers. So try the Grinch's new meal and head down to Macca's. Until 4th of Jan from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary while stocks last. Grinched for adults.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
I think I underestimated the role that Liz Truss could play in helping us understand what Donald Trump's foreign policy strategy statement is playing out, trying to create this idea of Europe being a place where your freedom of speech is under threat or where you are likely to be attacked by a foreigner, even though, of course, you are measurably much, much safer in London and any British city than you are in most American cities. But this is what a former prime minister is saying for coins on YouTube. And it is so obviously and demonstrably untrue. Listen to the last line of it as well, which might remind people of a certain age of a martini advert from my own youth. But this is, I don't even know what it is, but it does make a little bit more sense of the lies that Donald Trump's policy statement tells about Europe. And no wonder she thinks she's got a job. She thinks she can play a role. I'm a former prime minister and I'm happy to repeat all these lies. I served in countless Conservative cabinets. I think I served in more Conservative cabinets than any other politician who served in Conservative cabinets in the last 15 years. But guess what? I'm now for sale. I'm for hire. I'll spout whatever bills you want me to spout if the price is right. I'm Liz Truss, and welcome to the counter-revolution.
People are in despair. but they're not even allowed to talk about it. If you speak out against the Islamists or the transgender ideologues, you can be arrested. Any time, any place, anywhere.
Okay. I don't know whether it's time for an intervention here or medical help or I don't know what. I'm almost loath to draw attention to this because it may create the illusion of success. I imagine if 10 of us tuned in to watch it, it would double the overall viewing figures. But this is what the former Prime Minister Liz Truss is currently doing for coins online. And we're worrying or wondering about whether or not it can have a deleterious effect on 15-year-olds. Danielle's in Hampstead. Danielle, what would you like to say?
Hi. I can't believe I'm on the radio. It's hilarious. But I have... I know,
like, why? Why is it hilarious?
I listen to you all the time in the morning, and I'm American living in London, and okay. I just love your perspective on Trump.
Are you mad? How could you possibly have moved to this hellhole?
I moved 6 years ago. It's gotten worse.
It is just... you can't go anywhere. I bet you haven't left the house since 2020, since Liz Truss was Prime Minister. You probably haven't left the house, have you? Anyway,
right before breakfast. But my point was, I have a three-year-old toddler, and I'm giving birth to an infant next week.
Okay.
And I'm terrified of social media, and I think it is so dangerous. I totally support a ban. I think it should be a global ban. Mm. I think that people, I mean, your previous caller, she was mentioning something about 16. I mean, their brains are more developed, they're more independent people, and hopefully they have a better perspective at 16. When they're younger, you have this thing, you know, that's called emotional targeting and advertising.
Yep.
So these advertisers, if a young girl takes down a photo, to them, that means that she's not keen on the way she looks.
Where did this come from? Just remind me where you got that from, that simple fact, because it's appeared quite recently, hasn't it?
It has. I went to one of the colleagues that I work with, and a mom, she's a policymaker, and she was helping. And there's a group, Count on Moms, in the States that are all of these mothers who've lost children or things, really sad stories about social media and the influence it had on their children to take their lives.
And someone's done that research. So the story for people who aren't familiar with it is if a young girl puts up a picture of herself and then takes it down, it sets off an alarm bell somewhere saying, here's someone with low self-esteem. We can sell her stuff.
It's all algorithms.
Yeah.
And in the whole incel community, I mean, that's real with boys. That happened in COVID. It got worse in COVID. And, you know, I feel like these mega social media companies and all of this AI that's going to even get worse, I mean, they're based on extracting data. So they're built platforms to be addictive, to have the children spend so much time on it and then collect data and then feed you advertisements or feed you, and, you know, bad content, scary content, shocking content. It's more addictive, right? So kids will get looped into an algorithm and build their own algorithm. And I find it so dangerous without any kind of parent guidance.
And of course, we can all be in favor of more parent guidance and more work on these fronts. But the point is... No, A, that doesn't include every parent. There are a few more boring phone-ins than the ones where... where people ring in and say, well, I never needed this, so why does anybody else need it? I know how to change a nappy, so why do we need to teach parents how to change nappies? I mean, it's just a pointless, utterly pointless conversation. What society exists to do is pursue the greater good for everybody. And how can anybody object to the idea of... limiting the access these people have to our children. They turn it on its head, you've just done that. So we're not talking about limiting our children's access to the platforms. We're talking about limiting these ghouls and vampires access to
taking
our children.
Taking advantage of them, I agree. Yeah, I wholly support it. I think it's fantastic and it should happen real soon.
And you speak from the knowledge that despite the very, very best intentions and even having the time and the inclination and the knowledge to try to keep an eye on this kind of thing, the parent who thinks they've got it covered is almost always the parent who is in for the biggest shock of all. It's Caitlin Regair, who works at UCL, who I find myself turning to a lot on this kind of stuff. She's brilliant. She's written a book as well called, I think it's called Smartphone Nation, and she is just fantastic. She's been on the show, and I think I was with her the other day when I mentioned the algorithmic way in which the young girl putting up a picture of herself and then taking it down immediately just sort of alerts these people or these platforms, these algorithms, to the possibility that you're looking at someone with low self-esteem, someone who's more likely to buy makeup or someone who's more likely to buy things that you would associate with poor or poor body image. Wow. Thank you, Danielle. Steve's in Weston. Steve, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. A long-time listener. I've just ordered your book for my Christmas present.
That's very kind. Well, for yourself...
Yes.
That's nice. Everyone should buy themselves a Christmas present.
Absolutely.
Yeah, quite, I like it. I like it. Good man.
The glass caller, very, very, very good. I didn't agree with anything the caller before the advert said.
No, she. Maybe I was a little bit brutal with her. It was only because I warned I was going to spit the pips out. Then I thought I had an image to live up to. But I did see. I could see where she was coming from. And at risk of sounding patronising, when my kids were that age, I thought that they'd never have screens. I remember saying on the radio, "There's no way my children will ever have screens." And then suddenly you've got an 8-hour drive to the middle of France ahead of you, and they could watch Peppa Pig for half of it, and it's a no-brainer, isn't it? So that's all I'd say about that.
Yeah. Now, I think I'm hoping the Australian model works.
Yeah.
And then that will then give our government a kick up the backside. I really do hope it works.
And that's it, isn't it? I mean, the effort. No one is ever lobbying for children. There's no Tufton Street lobby group masquerading as a think tank that is being secretly funded by parents to protect their children and look after their children. All of the lobby groups coming up with dodgy research or claiming that they've done some academic insights into stuff which miraculously tally entirely with what their paymasters want them to be putting into the public sphere. Nobody, unless you get a Jamie Oliver type figure, nobody is sticking up for the children here. It's all for the platforms.
Yeah, I've got 3 grandsons under 12 and I worry what they're going to be exposed to. I mean, it's not like me and you, we're about the same age. Books was our study for homework. My youngest lad is 28, and he's got some of his peers openly confessed to never opening an encyclopedia for doing homework.
Never seen anything. I'm less troubled by that than you are, because some of the stuff they can find online is brilliant and powerful, and it's replaced the page, as it were. It's replaced. It's like the written word is still there. It's just written on a different format. But that idea of losing 4 to 5 hours a day of leisure time is a positive, not a negative. It feels like a negative. How am I going to fill 4 to 5 hours a day? It's a massive positive. How am I going to fill four to... Just think about saying it in a different way. So here's your 14-year-old facing a ban on social media. What am I going to do? How am I going to fill 4 hours a day? And then say it differently. Say, wow, how am I going to fill 4 hours a day? The world is my lobster. Don't at me on that. I think it's a Del Boy joke, isn't it? But it wasn't a mistake on my part. Think of all the things you could be doing instead. There you go. That's the answer.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday. Flights and trains have been cancelled and thousands of homes left without power because of Storm Bram. Large parts of the UK are covered by weather warnings with amber danger to life alerts in parts of Scotland and Northern Ireland. There could be gusts of up to 90 miles per hour in some places. Dan Stroud is a forecaster at the Met Office.
That's enough to make travelling extremely challenging, but also bring down sort of trees in some spots. So it's really a case of, again, taking extra care. There could be a lot of debris flying around as well at times.
A report into the top British spy inside the IRA has found he committed crimes of the worst possible kind. Operation Canova's chair says there is now a compelling ethical case for the government to confirm Steak Knife's identity. The agent is widely believed to be Freddie Scappaticci, who died in 2023. Sky's Ireland correspondent Stephen Murphy is in Belfast.
We understand that the UK's government position is there are some outstanding civil legal issues which prevent such a naming taking place, and it always runs contrary to the policy of neither confirm nor denies. That always protected the identity of these intelligence assets even after they were deceased.
Two men are due to appear in court charged over a robbery at Heathrow. More than 20 people were hit with pepper spray during the incident at a multi-storey car park on Sunday. Tyrone Richards and Anton Clark Butcher, who are 31 and 24, are accused of robbery and administering a noxious substance. An NHS leader has called on people to wear a mask in public if they have flu or cold symptoms. Daniel Elkeles, the head of NHS providers, says hospitals are dealing with a tidal wave of a very nasty strain of flu. Some have declared major incidents as a result. Australia's social media ban for under-16s is due to take effect in the next hour. Platforms including Instagram, TikTok and YouTube have been forced to block more than a million accounts. It's intended to protect children from extreme material, but critics say it risks doing more harm than good. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 96.55. That's up 9 points. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 14. LBC weather, wet and windy for most parts as the storm moves in, with those more severe conditions in western areas. A high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the sports media industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Niamh, a sports media student in year 12.
During class, I've edited football videos for socials, reported on games, and even produced my own highlight packages. Working directly with the industry makes me excited for my future career in sports broadcasting.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Minutes after 12 is the time, and as if by magic, here is a headline seeking to denigrate something that would be for the public good, that relies upon contributions from precisely one of those institutions who have very opaque funding and always seem to come out trying to resist social improvement. You couldn't make it up, could you, given what we were talking about in the last hour? There's a topic there. Will you remind me? There's two topics. It's only Tuesday lunchtime. There's two topics that have popped up this week that we haven't done that have occurred to us in the course of doing other topics. Who would like to go to the top of the class by remembering what yesterday's was? Do you remember what yesterday's was? Does anybody remember what yesterday? Am I the only one that remembers what yesterday? I bet I'm not. I bet I'm not. What's the point? Next time we do neats, we're going to do what's the point. I mean, it's a bleak question, but increasingly I find the public discourse moving to a place we arrived at some time ago, which was not, oh, back in my day, they just needed to kick up the bum, they'd soon be going to work if they were going hungry and all that kind of thing. All being said by people for whom the point was obvious when they began their journey up the ladder of life. But when you're trying to tell a young person who's got no prospect ever of owning a home or enjoying job security or even perhaps a permanent contract as opposed to a rolling contract or a 0 hours contract, what is the point of getting involved? What is the point of joining the rat race? Tell someone in that category, that cohort, what the point is. That popped up yesterday, pertinent to the thing we're about to talk about now, but the second bit that we might do, the second topic to pop up this week, is the difference between spending too much time on social media and spending too much time elsewhere online. Do you see what I mean? Because one of my girls watches a lot of movies, and she watches them on her laptop because that's what suits her, despite us having... we do actually have televisions, plural, in the house. We're very posh. Actually, no, we're not very posh, are we? If we were very posh, we wouldn't have any televisions at all. But anyway, so I've got no worries whatsoever about them watching films online, about them watching actual movies online, or indeed about them using e-books. So the simple notion of screen time being bad seems to me is a bit redundant now, but we haven't quite caught up with it. Screen time is not, by definition, bad. Video games. The last couple of video games I've played have been absolutely extraordinary. They've been beautiful. Three video games I've played since rediscovering my video game mojo about, 12 months ago, was it? A bit less? I've played Indiana Jones and the Grand Circle, I've played Hogwarts Legacy, and I've played Mafia the Old Country, and I have been transported and transfixed, and something else that begins with trans. Oh, better be careful, otherwise the Liz Truss police will arrest me. But something else that be transposed? No, that doesn't work. Transfigured? Can you be transfigured? Anyway, I've been transfixed. Translated? I don't know. And they are works of art. So, you know, that my dad's generation, who thought we were spending too much time online, now it's a bit like stepping into the pages of a novel or actually being in a film. Some of these games are magical. And they're not very fighty, the games that I've just... well, the Mafia one is. Actually, so is the Harry Potter. Actually, and the Indiana... All right, they're all very fighty, but they've got lots of story to them. So the one I'm playing at the moment, Ghost of Tsushima, which I've only just started and I haven't really got into it. At the moment, that's too fighty. Not enough stealth and creeping around. I need to find a bow and arrow, and then I'll be able to do the stealth. Anyway, I digress. Screen time per se is not the bad thing. So that's the other topic that we're not doing now, but we are going to do at some point in the future. The difference between social media and all the other things that children can do on screens, and why the former is so much more dangerous and dodgy than all the other things. So here's a headline. Inevitably, perhaps, in the Daily Telegraph. Take a week off if your distant cousin dies. So you're supposed to read this and think, oh, my God, the government are attacking employers again. Until you get to the second or third paragraph, where it will say could, as opposed to will. Sir Keir Starmer's boo, workers' rights bill. Here it comes, second paragraph, second sentence, could grant employees a week's leave following the deaths of in-laws, cousins, uncles and nieces. Yeah, down with that sort of thing. Compassion, concern, care. A death within an employer's chosen family. There it is. So you literally tell your employer about the deaths that are likely to hit you hardest and receive, in return, compassionate leave. In the world of the Daily Telegraph, straight on the phone to somebody from the so-called Adam Smith Institute, it's a negative, it's a bad thing. Indeed, here is someone from the so-called Adam Smith Institute. I think one of the ones, here we go, Transparify ranked the Institute as one of the four least transparent think tanks in the United Kingdom in relation to funding. Goes back 10 years. Maybe they've improved since. But in 2022, the website Who Funds You rated the Institute at E, which is their lowest transparency rating. And Tobacco Tactics, the website of the Tobacco Control Research Group at the University of Bath, has detailed the Institute's funding by the tobacco industry, with The Guardian reporting. Remember, they keep this as secret as they can, generally speaking, but The Guardian found that about 3% of its funding had come from the tobacco industry in 2011. So who wouldn't ring them up for a view on compassionate leave for bereaved people? Yeah. The proposal may look compassionate, but it threatens to impose significant costs and administrative burdens on employers at a time when businesses can least afford it. What did I tell you? Throughout the entire last hour, none of these outfits will ever do anything because it's the right thing to do. They will only ever do it because they have to. So even bereavement leave, even compassionate leave, can be dressed up by the usual ghouls and vampires as something passionately to be resisted. How long does it take before you can have a phone in and people will ring in to say, oh, it's outrageous. They shouldn't be allowed to have time off for a distant cousin that you've never met, which absolutely nobody is suggesting. You have friends, probably, whose loss would hit you harder than the loss of a family member. Am I right? Your very best friend in the world would, losing them, partly because of age reasons and the unexpected nature of losing somebody young, would hit you harder than losing a grandparent, perhaps, or certainly a great aunt or a great uncle. This is not, by the way, a suggestion that everybody's in that category, or that you love your friends more than everybody loves all their friends, more than everybody loves all their grandparents. But, I don't want to start crying on the programme, but the moments where I would have really appreciated a day or two off involve essentially my late father, when I took some time off, and a very close friend who I lost during lockdown. And I could have really benefited from just a couple of days of not having to, well, probably get out of bed. One of the weird things about my job is I can come into the studio at 1 minute to 10, feeling absolutely rotten. I hope you can't tell when I've got stuff going on in my private life that is difficult or traumatic, but I can carry it into the studio at 1 minute to 10. And then, oddly, I'm fine until 1 o'clock. And then it hits me again, whatever it is that I'm struggling with or worrying about, illness or you know, something very personal life related. And it's one of those jobs, I've always suggested it's a bit like flying an aeroplane, where you can't not concentrate. I'm now going to get atted by lots of pilots to tell me they just press a button and put their feet up for 8 hours. But you take my point. It's one of those jobs where the level of focus that is required is so high that it takes you out of yourself. But even with that knowledge, I really would have struggled to face you on the morning after I lost my dad. And I did struggle to face you on the morning after I lost my friend. I've been relatively blessed when it comes to bereavement in my life and grief. It means I've got, you know, a lot ahead of me, doesn't it? But relatively blessed in the context of what I've had to process. And there are two points here that I would like to draw your attention to. I've already done the first, if there were going to be three. It's the way that the coverage of this particular proposal is disgusting. And you can tell how disgusting it is by the list of organizations that you have to ring as a journalist to get them to join in attacking something as simple and straightforward as allowing people to mourn the death of somebody they love. How can we turn it into a negative? Let's pretend they hardly know them, boss. Yep, nice one. Front page, tomorrow, Daily Telegraph. Let's pretend you hardly know them. I'm mourning the death of a distant cousin that I've never met. I've got a whole week off work. In fact, I'm going to be able to get 52 weeks off work because I'm Irish and my parents come from massive families. I've got 104 cousins. If they all start dying at the same time, I could get a whole year off work on foot. I mean, it's just stupid, the reasoning here. But that, of course, never stops the right wing from trying to shove it down the throats of their readers, listeners, and indeed voters. So I've got two things going on here. One is obvious, and one is a bit less obvious. And I want you to think about the less obvious one first, because it's going to sound like a really weird question, but it's not, I promise you. Why does it matter? What difference does it make? Not just in the context of grieving and mourning, but also, I suspect, in the relationship you have with your work. If you are compelled to drag yourself to work when you are crying inside and quite possibly outside, I bet it changes the way you feel about your work, about your employer. What, why? I know this is a really stupid question in some ways, but if you've got, you know, newspapers sticking stories on their front pages, trying to denigrate the very idea of allowing people to mourn the death of someone they love, then you need to remind ourselves, we need to remind ourselves why it matters. What difference does it make having a little bit of time off work to mourn someone you love? 0345 6060973. And then I want you to tell me what has happened. I want you to tell me both good and bad stories about what has happened when you, I mean self-employed people, when you're really up against it. I don't get paid if I don't come to work. So you know, that idea that you would go to your nan's funeral in the morning and be back at work by lunchtime, that if you're self-employed, you're in a world of your own, aren't you, really? You've got nobody you can really turn to. The decision is yours. Can I afford it? Can I afford it mentally, psychologically, emotionally, but ultimately financially? So it's going to be going to an employer and asking for compassionate leave. And it is absolutely right that people would be allowed to identify the humans whose loss would hit them hardest. It would be ridiculous to say you can have it for grandmothers but not for best friends, because most people are going to be hit harder by the death of a best friend. Not most people, many people, a great-grandmother, a great-aunt, someone who's close to you on a family tree but not close to you in your actual lived experience, in your real life. What I want to do is two things. I want to know what happened when you lost someone and work either stepped up to the plate and helped you, or to your shock and horror, to your shock and continuing horror, they sort of hung you out to dry. Your experience, really, of bereavement leave. 0345 6060 973. And oddly, why it matters. What difference that experience makes, or what difference that moment makes to your relationship both with grief and with work. Okay? So one of those is quite easy to answer because it's happened to you and you can tell me what it was like. But one of them, I think, might be a little bit harder to answer. The things you've had to do, the times you've had to go to work when you really shouldn't have had to, but you knew that the employer would be so unsympathetic that it was not worth the hassle, the horror of either sticking up for yourself or insisting on time off. Do you know, there's only one circumstance in which bereavement leave is mandatory, and that's if you lose a child under 18. I mean, could you imagine an employer saying, sorry, you can't have any time off to mourn the loss of a child aged under 18? But what about a child aged 18 and a half? Sorry, I'm not required by law. What did we talk about in the last hour? A lot of people, not everyone, won't do anything unless they have to. Well, I've just lost my 18-year-old. Oh, I'm sorry. When was their birthday? Well, last Tuesday. Yeah, see, if he died on Monday, you could have had a week off. But they didn't, did they? So I'm afraid you're going to have to come to work tomorrow, whether you like it or not. 0345 60 60 973 is the number that you need. It's a great idea. It really is. And it should be celebrated and greeted warmly, which is almost certainly why the Daily Telegraph are trying to encourage you to attack it.
This is LBC.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Got any tips for the football?
Your best bet is to head over to BetVictor. They're giving new customers a terrific welcome offer. If you bet a minimum of £10, they'll give you £30 in free bets.
Phew, that's a steal of a deal.
It's a good darn deal that'll make you squeal for real. Neil?
My name's not Neil.
I know, but it rhymes.
Listen to Harry and make your best bet on the football at BetVictor. 18 plus, opt in and bet on any football marketing at odds of evens or greater. No cash out, 7-day expiry. Terms and conditions apply at gambleaware.org.
At Morrisons, our Christmas centrepieces are better than half price. Pick up a British beef joint for £6.49 per kilo, a whole leg of lamb for £7.50 per kilo, or British pork loin for £3.75 per kilo. Morrisons, making more of Christmas. Majority of stores and online excludes Morrison's Daily. Max 4 in store, 2 online, was £8 to £19 per kilo. Ends 24th of December.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, top up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with...
Think. Do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 60 60 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
20 minutes after 12 is the time. Do you remember Susan Hall, the London politician who lost her purse and claimed a crime wave? I mean, it was one of the maddest things I think I've ever experienced in the context of the relationship between media and politics. She literally lost her purse and claimed it was all Sadiq Khan's fault, and it was all evidence of a crime wave. And she was booked to appear on The Breakfast Show, but her purse turned up before she got here. So she still appeared with Nick. Nick still talked to her. And she kind of had to continue pretending that a member of the public finding a purse that she'd lost and handing it into Lost Property with the money still in it was proof that Sadiq Khan was a rubbish mayor. So she is nothing if not an enthusiastic contributor to the gaiety of the nation. But she has picked a new fight. It's not with Good Samaritans who hand in Lost Property, which is the last thing that got her into the news. She's picked a new fight, and I want you to tell me whether she has picked a fight with the woke mind virus, some biscuits. I got a bit distracted. Has Susan Hall, the woman who lost her purse and claimed it was a crime wave after it got handed in, has she picked a fight with the woke mind virus, some biscuits, or Transport for London? What is it that she is now, this doughty defender of human rights, one of the few people that says it like it is and speaks up for British values? Has she now picked a fight with the woke mind virus, some biscuits, or Sadiq Khan's Transport for London? Answers on a postcard, please. Hamish is in Tring to lead us back to the... Actually, before I talk to you, Hamish, I'm going to read a message that I mentioned I'd be careful not to cry this hour, but if I was going to, I think I would have gone already, because this is from Katie. My best friend committed suicide a few years ago. It was one of the hardest things I've ever been through. I was allowed 2 days off, James, one to grieve and one for the funeral, but only if I used up my holiday allowance. I even suggested unpaid leave, but I was told no. As much as I want to, I can't forgive the manager and the company that did that to me. And there it is, you know, that is precisely the circumstance that the Adam Smith Institute is complaining about in the Daily Telegraph today. that a friend doesn't have any obvious connection with you, and therefore the idea that you deserve compassionate leave to mourn them is disgraceful or wrong. A death within an employee's chosen family, which you can define as close friends, would qualify you for unpaid time off. So not even paid, but Katie didn't even get that. Hamish is in Tring. Hamish, what made you pick up the phone? I think we've lost Hamish. Can we try and get him back while I talk to James in Westminster? James, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Just on the topic of time off, I was a police officer quite young in service when I got a phone call one day on duty that my grandmother had died. And I requested to take the following day off work, not for myself, but mainly to be there for my father, who just lost his mother. As a support network. I was denied that request because I was told that it wasn't a member of my immediate household who had died, and I'd only be granted a day off for the funeral when that took place.
Okay. How did you feel about that? Because, I can see this example from both sides, actually, oddly.
Yeah, of course.
If it had been your parent that had passed away, it would feel a lot more brutal than your parent's parent. But the fact that someone needs to be with the grieving child of the parent, again, and I'd have hoped that the public service might be more accommodating than the private sector, albeit that will get another front page attack from the Daily Telegraph. But how did it make you feel to be told that?
Absolutely. I mean, my colleagues who I work with are very supportive, but it was actually HR who denied my request, so it was more of a sort of faceless
computer says
entity.
No.
Exactly that. Yeah, so I didn't take it too personally. I ended up taking it off anyway and manufactured it as sort of forced leave / sick day.
Right.
So my team managed to cover the numbers, so there wasn't a deficit in the work group. But also on the topic you mentioned about a best friend, I lost my best friend last year to a very sudden accident, unfortunately.
Sorry.
And it did affect me more, I think, losing my best friend than it would do probably losing, like you say, a distant member of my family. I'm actually self-employed now, and I inversely chose to keep working during that, rightly or wrongly. I thought my mindset at the time was to keep focusing on work and probably delay the shock response, as it were, and rather than take a week off work. And I found it more comforting to keep myself busy, if that makes any sense.
Yes, it does. I mean, it would make sense either way, but you're distracting yourself, I think.
Yeah, of course.
And processing it more slowly than you would have done otherwise, which isn't necessarily an option if it's a very close family member, if it's a, you know, or indeed, to use that dreadful phrase from HR, if it's someone from the same household as you, you can't really distract yourself from the emptiness, can you? But if it's a really close friend, you probably can. Did it change the way you felt about the force, the fact they treated you like that, or did you kind of just move through it?
It just made me feel a little bit more like a number when, like you say, computer said no, and it was just, they didn't sort of take into consideration, you know, that any closeness there, or the fact that I was there to support my father more than anything. It wasn't for my own personal necessity to take a day of grieving.
It wasn't a slip of the tongue there. It is computer says no, because, the days maybe of living in a working in an environment where humanity trumps tradition are probably over. You're probably, unless you're working for a tiny firm or a family firm, you're probably going to rely upon rubric, rely upon rules and regulations, and that the case you make won't matter. So you don't understand. This person is like a brother to me. This person means more to me than anybody that I'm related to. Please, may I have some time off to mourn them? And they'll be like, well, I wish I could, but I can't, because the rules are the rules. In fact, that's not a million miles away from what Suzanne describes. I'm not calling, James, because I'll just cry. I lost my very close friend, who was like a sister to me, on the 29th of October. Had a very stressful year, separation, moving out of my family home. She supported me through all of that, then died unexpectedly in the middle of my move, and I've been knocked for six. She died from suicide. Work have been great, but I have had to go on sick leave, not bereavement leave. A doctor can support you in this situation, and it is only for a close family member, and that really needs to change. I'm not suggesting this is a nice conversation. I'm suggesting it's a nice piece of legislation that recognises the reality of most of our lives, and that involves, oddly, I mean, a sibling, perhaps more obviously, being someone you're not that close to, whereas a friend, your best friend, is someone who is going to leave a much bigger hole in your life. And for your employer simply to accommodate that with the, you know, correct checks and balances in place to guard against abuses seems to me to be something to welcome. I'd celebrate would feel like the wrong word, but certainly to welcome. I think we've got Hamish back on the line in Tring. Hamish, what would you like to say?
Yes, good morning, James. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Yeah, this is a very close subject to my heart. 7 years ago, I lost my 21-year-old daughter suddenly.
Mate, I'm sorry.
Thank you. And it was, as you can imagine, it's an earthquake. We had no idea she'd die.
Yeah.
And she had an epileptic seizure, which killed her, unfortunately. My company, this is a lovely story, really. My company gave me so much space.
Yeah.
And they gave me, they didn't put any time on anything. I just let them know what had happened. My views are that by treating those people who are grieving with respect and humanity, as you say, you end up forming a closer relationship with your employers and employees, and they... no one would do this to shirk, I don't think. I mean, I had to organise a funeral, check my wife, my other daughters were okay. We had to deal with the coroner. We had to do all this sort of stuff, which you can't do if you're just called back to work instantly.
Oh, of course you can't. Although it wouldn't be statutory. I've only discovered that today because of the age that she was when she passed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, and I, if I don't mind mentioning, but Marsh are a big insurance company. They were just treated me with such humanity. And I think in aggregate, I took about a month off. That was about it. But when I got back, I felt welcome. Everyone understood. They were accommodating, and they gave me even more space during that year.
I'm glad you brought that up. I was hesitating to ask whether or not it meant you went back to work with a sort of... with a warmer feeling towards your employer than you would have done otherwise. Because it makes perfect sense. I love that word aggregate as well.
Yeah.
In that if you wanted to be quite bean countery about it.
Yeah.
I remember that James Timpson saying this to me about the way he treats his employees, which is, you know, an industry model on generosity and kindness. But he says it's actually good for business because they work harder for me. When you show people respect and humanity, they repay you twice fold.
And it's actually quite an interesting observation. I've obviously never had any experience of losing someone so close.
Oh, of course.
But in my career, I've seen other people who've had equal tragedies, whether losing a partner or spouse or other relatives. And I have to say, my industry, whether it's unique or not, I can't say, but I have to say my industry is just very nice. It's just very kind and caring.
Well, is that because you deal with people in crisis as insurers, or is it not that sort of insurance?
I don't know if there's a reason. They just seem to be very accommodating and very caring, and I think they get more out of people. I don't think it's a cold calculation. I just think it's the right thing to do. And and I think as a result of that, they get increased loyalty and probably performance if you were to turn it into pounds, shillings and pence. But... My company was absolutely superb.
That's lovely to hear. And I'm so sorry that you obviously went through the loss that you went through to discover that. And thank you for sharing it, because it's a really good point, a really interesting point that speaks essentially to the algorithm versus the human, doesn't it? So, you know, the idea that you treat people who are going through the worst imaginable experiences with anything other than care and compassion should be anathema. But it's not, because there's somebody somewhere counting beans. And that's why... it's interesting that even the bean counter should have it in front of them, or should be aware of the possibility that treating somebody well is actually good for the business as opposed to bad for the business. That's the problem with the sort of Tufton Street outlook, is that people aren't people. They're just money-making units. They don't get treated with humanity or decency. Children are there to provide profits for the people selling sugar and sweets and fizzy drinks. Adults are there to provide profits for the people gambling, or the people smoking, or the people driving fossil fuel, providing fossil fuel products. People aren't human. They're just units in a money-making process, which is how you end up with somebody from the Adam Smith Institute going after this legislation in the pages of the Daily Telegraph. Well, it's outrageous. Won't somebody think of the employer? Sorry, my best friend's just died. Yes, but won't somebody think of the employer? Okay, It's 12:32. Amelia Cox has your headlines.
The UK government has been urged to reveal the identity of a British spy who committed crimes the worst possible kind while operating in the IRA. A report into the agent known as State Knife has found there is a compelling ethical case to confirm his true identity. Storm Bram has caused major travel disruption and left thousands of homes without power. Large areas of the UK are covered by weather warnings, and in parts of Scotland and Northern Ireland there are amber danger to life alerts. And there are more calls for people to wear a mask in public if they have flu or cold symptoms. The head of NHS providers, Daniel L. Kelly, says hospitals are dealing with a tidal wave of a very nasty strain of the virus. LBC weather starting dull and wet this afternoon, but rain will become confined to the north later, brightening up in the south, a windy day with gales in the northwest, a high of 15 degrees.
This is LBC.
This festive season at McDonald's,
get rich deals every day.
Okay, okay.
With a sausage sandwich for just...
Let's see, 9 an MP.
Six chicken McNuggets for just...
9 an MP.
Fine. Get Grinch deals every day
in the McDonald's app.
18 plus app only. Ends 24th of December. One use per offer. Fees apply to delivery. Participation varies. T's and C's apply.
Yep. I'm still dancing. And there's still time to get in tonight's EuroMillions draw. So turn up that dial.
The EuroMillions jackpot is £125 million.
Go on, play on app.
Estimated jackpot. Account terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
The congestion charge helps to reduce traffic in central London. To ensure it remains effective while incentivising the switch to electric vehicles, from the 2nd of January, electric cars will be charged a 25% discounted rate of £13.50 rather than the new daily charge of £18. To receive the discount, electric cars must be registered on AutoPay. Further discounts are available for other electric vehicles. Search TfL AutoPay. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
Waitrose presents...
Hello. Oh, so hello. Good to see you.
Festive Fizz offers. One host raises a glass to her friend's new beginnings. Starring fresh and fruity San Leo Prosecco.
To your lovely new place.
Rich, creamy night timber.
To your promotion.
And Bollinger, with notes of roasted apple.
And to you, finally passing your driving test.
Seventh time lucky.
Waitrose, the home of food lovers. Selected lines and stores subject to availability. Prices may vary in Channel Islands at the Waitrose and Partners and Concessions.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
I've done it again. I always mean to tell you when I've got one of my favourite guests coming up, because it might be one of your favourite guests as well, and you can build up a little bit of anticipation and excitement, but I completely forgot. Phillips O'Brien is here, the Professor of Strategic Studies at the University of St Andrews, and one of the people we turn to fastest when Donald Trump getting involved in international relations again, most obviously at the moment, of course, with reference to Russia in particular and the national security strategy that we were talking about in the first hour of the programme, and the points at which those two phenomena meet. He's given an interview, I think, this morning to Bild, the German newspaper, in which he essentially calls upon Volodymyr Zelensky, and I quote, to get his act together, suggests that Russia has the upper hand in peace negotiations and that Zelensky needs to start accepting things. Not exactly the language you'd expect, Phillips, from a FIFA Peace Prize winner.
Well, actually, I think it's quite refreshing that he's just actually speaking his own truth. This is his view. You know, we've been dealing for months with so much BS, James, about people thinking, oh, Trump might help Ukraine. Trump will be tough on Putin. And Trump actually feeding this nonsense by saying, oh, maybe I'll send tomahawks. All of that was a lie. But people bought the lie. I actually like the fact that they have the national security strategy out there. And we have Trump saying, you know, Zelensky, you're in trouble, get out. You know, we want to settle the war in Putin's favor, which is what he's saying, because that's what he believes.
Yeah.
And it means that Europeans can't pretend that somehow the U.S. is on their side and that the U.S. will get a good deal for Ukraine. The Europeans now have to accept the U.S. is actually an impediment to Europe, is a threat to European democracy, and they have to act to look after their own interests. So I actually like these comments. I'm glad they're being said, and I want them to be amplified as much as possible.
Well, that's why you're here. Are they born of frustration? I mean, is Trump, is the petulance now coming to the surface because Zelensky hasn't been bullied into accepting the terms laid down effectively by, let's not beat about the bush, the terms laid down by Vladimir Putin via Donald Trump's White House?
Absolutely. I mean, well, Trump had a deal with Putin. They worked it out, 28-point plan. Trump's view was that they could bully Ukraine into taking it. So far, the Ukrainians have not taken it. So now, of course, he makes the threats not to Putin, but to the Ukrainians, and specifically to Zelensky. We have to understand, Trump hates Zelensky.
Yeah.
Hates him personally.
Why?
Wants
Why?
Zelensky.
Why? Yeah. Why?
The Hunter Biden laptop. Remember, everything with Trump is personal.
Yeah.
So he views Zelensky as an enemy, that Zelensky didn't help him when he thought Zelensky should help him. So that
this is when he tried to withhold federal aid from Ukraine because he wanted Zelensky to help him dig up dirt on Hunter Biden. I mean,
Hunter Biden.
I mean, those were the days, weren't they, when we were shocked by that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly where it comes from. That's why he has said since he's become president the second time, one of his consistent themes is we have to have new elections in Ukraine. He and Putin are absolutely together on that because they both want to get rid of Zelensky.
For completely different reasons. Let me steer you, if I may, to the national security strategy. And I welcome your welcome of it, because, as you say, it strips away some of the fig leaves and camouflage that people have been hiding behind for whatever reason. But what is it designed to do? Why, for example, denigrate Europe, the whole of Europe, effectively, the demonization of Europe? That doesn't have much electoral calculus back in D.C., does it?
No, well, they actually think they're going to help people like Nigel Farage, like Marine Le Pen, like the AfD, like Viktor Orban. I mean, they view that these people are with them.
Wow.
And what they are signaling is the United States is with, with Farage, with the AfD. And so that they're going to try and actually interfere in European politics going forward. If you read the national security strategy, it is to interfere in European politics. Mm.
Well, Farage will be furious. He's on the record countless times on objecting to any American president. Oh, hang on, just the black one. It was just the black American president who wasn't allowed to interfere in European politics, wasn't it?
Yeah. I've not even seen Farage touch it at this point. So
He's hiding at the moment because he's got questions to answer about telling Jewish children at school that they should have gone into the gas chambers, allegedly. And also, of course, his own close friend, protege and party leader in Wales, currently in prison for taking bribes from a Kremlin stooge, for saying things in the public space that, as far as I can tell, Nigel Farage has also said. But no one is suggesting for a minute that he's accepted any bribes from Kremlin stooges. So it is a statement of intent of interference.
Absolutely. It does say the United States will try to work with parties that have their anti-immigrant, you might say, white supremacist view in Europe. In their minds, they are saving European society, but they're very clear about it in the national security strategy. And Trump, by the way, has reemphasized that today when he's saying Europe is weak. Europe is being destroyed by immigration. He particularly mentioned London as being, a source of weakness. So they're entirely open now about what they believe.
And just to flip it, if I may, to return to the question of why, because...
Yep.
I suppose, let me rephrase it, what's in it for him when he does that? So I can't imagine, despite his own leanings towards bigotry and ancient prejudices, he's much more transactional than that. What does he win from creating this context, from this environment?
He destroys the European Union, which he believes is a competitor to the USA.
Right.
What's also very clear in the national security strategy is they don't want to work with the European Union.
Yeah.
They want to work with, quote-unquote, individual sovereign European states. They want Europe to break up. And they believe that that will greatly amplify U.S. power and make the Europeans dependent on them. Because they still want the Europeans to do things like buy American weapons. Yeah, this is the benefit for the U.S. They want Europe to buy a lot from the U.S. They just don't want Europe to be a competitor to the U.S.
Not to have any heft. Not so all quid and no quo, as it were, and a supplicant trading partner rather than a comparable trading partner. Is there anything on the more political level? Because the EU, which is, an imperfect institution, as everybody knows, but it's a heck of a lot better than most of the obvious and available alternatives. Rules-based, accountable, transparent, all of the things that Trump seems to hate, a power, and all of the other big powers on the planet at the moment are closer to totalitarianism than they are to democracy, the ones that he admires most, like China and Russia. Does the EU pose an ideological threat to Trump as
well? I mean, that's what the national security strategy says. Yeah. It's open. The EU absolutely poses a threat to doing business. And the national security strategy is very clear. There are no ideals in foreign policy. Yeah. Things like democracy, freedom, they shouldn't matter. It's all, in a way, a zero-sum game. It's who makes the most money is the definition of success. And they look at the EU and they see something that is an impediment to that and also something that is, in their mind, weak and they can crush it. This is where European leaders have performed so disastrously by sucking up to Trump for 9 months now. They have debased themselves.
Yeah, especially Starmer.
And they're paying the price now because he views them as weak.
Because it's like trying to feed an insatiable appetite, as if we just throw him enough bones, then perhaps he won't chew us up, or at least he won't come for us. But of course he will. So the best thing you should be doing is getting your retaliation in early, getting it in first.
The best thing is what the Canadians have done. Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is Canada's closer and it has been far more robust in defending its own position than Europeans.
And one of the first fronts in this war, which, as you say, is now out in the open, will be online legislation, I think, will be telling the tech bros to sling their hook or to sort their own house out.
They hate European legislation against U.S. high tech companies. They just hate content protection and any kind of ability to regulate the kinds of things that are reported and shown. So, I mean, that's what they're coming for now, and that's why it's been sort of pushed by people like Elon Musk, who has been on a very anti-EU crusade for a number of days now.
Yes, indeed, he has. So, final question: what does failure look like? From their point of view, I mean, what should we be looking for as optimists, as glass half full merchants?
The optimist is Europe comes together,
right,
on a range of issues, acts together to defend European interests, and I would say the big one is they come together to help Ukraine.
So
that I think what Trump wants is European states to bully Ukraine with him to take a very bad peace. So he's hoping that European states pressure the Ukrainians to give up territory, accept the secondary status, and destroy their future. The good result is European states, you know, they don't tell Trump to stuff it. They don't yell. They don't insult Trump. They just say, no.
Yeah.
We are going to look after our own interests. You look after U.S. interests. That's fine. That's what you're going to do. But we're looking after our own interests, and we're going to do what we want, and we're going to help Ukraine.
It's quite a big silver lining, potentially, were that to be realized. I mean, not just in the context of Ukraine, but in the entire context of NATO. I didn't get you on in the first hour, Phillips, because I didn't want you to kill my phone in stone dead by saying all of the things that you've just said with such clarity and insight. But do you still have pinch-yourself moments? This is a conversation about a United States president siding with the Kremlin against Europe, and most obviously against the United Kingdom, the oldest and the staunchest ally.
The pinch, but it's more moments that I can't believe we were having discussions even a few days ago, would Trump help Ukraine?
Yeah.
So it's more that the people have willfully accepted fantasy.
Yeah.
And European leaders have accepted fantasy for such a long time. And that's what's driven me nuts, is that we've had, I mean, I don't know, James, you and I have had this discussion for a year. It's like, no, Trump is not going to help Ukraine. He is not going to break with Putin. And finally now, I think that message has gotten through. So the pinch me moments are, this is good. That's why I'm happy with this, because it's settling the issue, I hope. I hope.
When did you first realize that? Have you known that from the very, very start?
Yeah, I mean, I was saying it before Trump's election.
Yes, I thought you were.
Yeah, because
so you're the least surprised man in the world of strategic studies at the moment.
Because this is what he is. He likes Putin. He wants to work. And he was saying it loud and clear. With things like picking J.D. Vance as his vice president.
Yeah.
If he wanted any example of what he wanted, it was the selection of Vance. Vance is openly pro-Russian in his orientation, anti-Ukrainian. There was no mystery about any of this. The weird thing is why people chose to believe nonsense when there was nothing to it. And I think it was a combination of fear and dreaming.
Yeah, that's a good question, why people chose to believe what will soon be unanimously accepted as obvious from the very start. Phillips, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Phillips O'Brien, Professor of Strategic Studies at the University of St. Andrews. I would also recommend his written work, obviously, in this field on Substack and in books. You can find Phillips online. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. A few of you pointing out the light it casts on that state visit. You know, you understand the pragmatism of the decision to try to keep him sweet, but as Phillips has been telling us for the longest time, the futility of trying to keep him sweet when he will, of course, revert to type. It was, what was it, a frog and a scorpion? Did we ever get to the end of that analogy? Is it Aesop? Or certainly, is it a frog and a scorpion? A frog... The frog says he'll give the scorpion a lift over the river and says to the scorpion, as long as you don't bite. This is what Keir Starmer's, the state visit was a frog and a scorpion, wasn't it? So look, we'll give you all this pomp and ceremony. We'll treat you like a latter-day emperor. We'll give you all of the golden carriages you can imagine. You can even meet the king. You can sit next to the queen, poor woman. But in return, please don't treat us with the contempt that you treat everybody else. And they said, yeah, all right. And then the scorpion is on the frog's back, and they're halfway across the river because the frog has said, you won't bite me, will you? You won't sting me if I carry you across the river. They get halfway across the river, and the scorpion stings the frog. They both drown. And as they're drowning, the frog says, what are you doing? He just says, it's just, I'm a scorpion. It's what I do. I'm Donald Trump. It's what I do. The only question is whether or not he goes down with all of the people that he's stinging. It's 12:49.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Why do cyclists think they can go through red lights? And another review asking why maternity care is so poor. We already know, we already know, we already know.
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
At Fidelity, we've been helping our customers plan for their retirement for nearly 20 years. From understanding how much you'll need, to combining multiple pensions, we offer expert insights, excellent service, and even financial advice, so you can feel confidently invested in your future. For pensions, advice, or investment accounts, be invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Transferring is not right for everyone. Terms apply.
This could be the best Christmas ever. Christmas Cash Call is here with a life-changing £350,000 to be won. Enter this week's draw before 5 p.m. Friday and you could get a call with £350,000. Christmas Cash Call. Text radio to 822 00 to enter now. Text costs £2.50 plus your standard network charge. 18 plus UK only, global network competition. Full rules and free entry at ChristmasCashCall.com.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m, includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last. Subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
Serious about the right vitamins for you and your family? Trust Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company, for expert nutritional care for every age and lifestyle. Vitamins for everyone, including Well Man, Well Woman, Well Baby, and Well Kid. From Boots, Pharmacies, and Vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see Vitabiotics.com.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
12:51 is the time. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I get distracted by contributions of Phillips's calibre, but of course the conversation we were in the middle of was about the rather warming proposal, if that's the right word, from the government contained within the Workers' Rights Bill that is being watered down in many areas as a consequence often of pressure from lobbyists who like to describe themselves as think tanks or I don't know, even journalists sometimes, but it is lobbyists working on behalf of business, working on behalf of wealth, working on behalf of capital, trying to chip away at any attempts by a Labour government to protect workers or to give workers things of social value. In this case, bereavement leave, literally time off work, unpaid. It's not even paid, but it hasn't stopped the usual suspects getting their knickers in a twist. Giving workers unpaid leave to mourn a loved one. And what an extraordinary tapestry of difference this has opened up in front of us, because some people having really quite moving experiences at the hands of their employers in a positive way, and some people having hideous experiences at the hands of their employers. So the need for legislation couldn't really be clearer. A level playing field. But of course, what else should that playing field contain? The questions we've been asking are about why it matters, why bereavement leave matters, and what experiences you yourself have had in this sphere, in this space. Steve's in Crawley. Steve, what would you like to say?
Hello, James.
Hello,
it was very
Steve.
Emotional last couple of days, because I tried to call you. I had input yesterday on your dementia call, but I didn't get through. But this one's probably even more personal. My best friend, who I'd known for over 50 years, such a good friend that when we moved to our current house over nearly 30 years ago, 3 days later, he moved in next door.
Right.
And we've been here ever since. Yeah, we've been here ever since. We do so many things together. He passed away March 2024 after a very short illness with cancer.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'm a wedding photographer.
Okay.
And he went into a St. Catherine's Hospice. Unbelievable place, by the way. Mm. So don't ever be frightened of a hospice. Quite an amazing place. He went into St. Catherine's Hospice. I got a call on the Thursday night from his son saying he wants to see you. So I knew what that meant.
Of course.
So I went in there and had probably the most emotional hour of my life. Just come back to me as I talk to you.
Of course.
And he was expected, sounds horrible, he was expected to die during the night. He managed to hang on for another 2 days, big sod, and decided to pass away. I had a wedding to shoot on the Sunday.
Oh, boy.
And I knew he was going to die that day. I got the phone call while I was driving back from the wedding. That was probably one of the most tough jobs I've ever had to do. So very much like you, I just had to bury it put it aside and get on with the job. And then when I got the phone call from his son driving home,
it just broke you. I'm just objecting to you saying it was a bit like me, because you have to be really cheerful. You're at a wedding, you're at the happiest day of someone's life. I can sit here and be as miserable as I want, Steve. As you well know.
It never sounds like that, though.
Bless
that,
you.
But no, it's just I just had to turn on full professional Steve and get on with it.
Mm.
I knew what was happening. I was getting some updates from my wife, but she obviously didn't send me the final one. She knew what time I was finishing, and his son called me literally as I was driving home, and I had to pull over.
Of course you did. What a reminder this is, though, of that simple thing I said at the outset about how friends being bigger and bigger parts of our lives than some family members,
absolutely,
than many family
absolutely
members. And the idea that the legislation or even that company policy doesn't recognise that at all. The more we talk about it, the more ridiculous it feels.
Yeah. I did give myself the day off for the funeral.
Yes. I'm very glad to hear
it. I had to have a long chat with myself, but we organised it.
You submitted a full account to HR, which you also happen to run, before passing it on to the CEO, which also happens to be you, who happily granted your request to you, which also happens to be you. Steve, thank you. It is 12:56. You're right, I have completely forgotten the reveal, as it were, of who it is that Susan Hall, the woman who lost her purse and described it as a crime wave, has picked a fight with. Now, I asked you, was it A, the woke mind virus? Was it B, some biscuits? Or was it C, Sadiq Khan's Transport for London? It's worth mentioning, actually, after that conversation with Phillips, that the people who join in with Donald Trump's denigration of our capital are latter-day Lord Hawhorse. They are literally helping an enemy, which he clearly is now, in the context of European politics, attack our fabric, the fabric of our society, the stuff that holds us together. So when foreign agents start attacking our country, or indeed helping fascistic politicians achieve power in our countries, they are very much in the same role that William Joyce found himself in the 1930s. But anyway, Susan Hall, was it A, the woke mind virus, B, some biscuits, or C, Transport for London that she has picked a fight with now, fresh from her attempt to portray losing her purse as being part of a London-wide crime wave? And the answer is some biscuits. She took a picture, or, I don't know, maybe she just nicked it off someone else, of a Morrison's biscuit, a bag of biscuits, 16 mini gingerbread people. And she wrote, this is an elected politician in the finest city in the world. In fact, I think she might be the leading, is she the senior Conservative politician in the London Assembly? Holy moly. Look at this nonsense, she wrote, and then she deployed the obligatory capital letters to write, no! They are gingerbread men, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. I mean, it's an extraordinary position to adopt, isn't it? To be part of the continuing denigration of our capital city while simultaneously thinking that the biggest issue of concern facing you at this particular moment in time is some Morrison's biscuits. Some Morrison's biscuits. They're not even Morrison's Best, which is a strand. Morrison's is my local supermarket, and Morrison's Best now stands comparison with any of the fancy premium ranges in any of the more expensive supermarkets. I'm yet to try the gingerbread people, and I never will, because I won't let the woke mind virus win. I will only buy gingerbread biscuits shaped like humans if they are described as gingerbread men. The question of how you can tell whether a gingerbread biscuit is a gingerbread man or a gingerbread woman is perhaps a question only Susan Hall could answer. That's it from me for today. If you missed any, would it cost more to get a gingerbread man? Because it would involve a tiny little bit more biscuit. I don't know.
Or a woman.
Or indeed a woman, depending upon which bit of the biscuit.
Two extra bits.
Two extra bits. They could be...
Three extra bits for a bloke.
Raisins.
Arguably. Where are we going?
We demand answers. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on Global Player or the LBC app, both of which are free and both of which allow you to stay up to date with everything but the LBC app, all the top stories, opinions, news categories. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a range of podcasts, including James O'Brien Daily, which is the best bits from this show every day. Hard to pick the best bits today, I think. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Tom Sawbrick will be with you at 4, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you, James. I just did a quick straw poll in the office of cyclists, of my colleagues who are cyclists. Quite a few of them are jumping red lights. Why do so many think that they can? Cyclists, that is. Two, a teacher was suspended from the school he taught at, then sacked from the school for telling a pupil the UK is a Christian country. Let's broaden that conversation out to not just whether it is, but how that whole situation should have been handled, could have been handled a lot better. But I want to start with the maternity review, the latest of many. Cumberledge, Kirkup, Ockenden, Care Quality Commission, and now the Amos review. Baroness Amos joins me in just a moment, I think, to tell us things we may already know.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, a report is calling for a top British spy inside the IRA to be formally identified after committing the worst possible crimes. The review concluded that there is a compelling ethical case for State Knife's identity to be confirmed. The UK government has a policy of neither confirming nor denying claims relating to intelligence issues. Sir Ian Livingstone is the officer in charge of Operation Canova.
NCND must be exercised in a proportionate and necessary manner and should not be an absolute bar to providing truth and justice. It cannot be used to protect agents who commit grotesque, serious crime, leaving victims and families ignored and their demands for information and answers dismissed.
State Knife is widely believed to be Freddie Scapaticci, who died in 2023. Hundreds of homes have been left without power and flights and trains have been cancelled as a result of Storm Bram. Danger to life weather warnings are in place for parts of Scotland, Wales and southwest England. Meteorologist Gemma Plum has told LBC the western side of the country is being affected the worst.
For some places, we could see up to 100 millimetres of rain within those warning areas. And that rain is falling in areas that have already seen a lot of rain recently. The ground is saturated, so there's the further risk of flooding in those areas. Within the warning for northwest Scotland, we're looking at wind gusts of up to 70 to 80 miles an hour for a few hours. But for some places, we could see gusts of up to 90 miles an hour. So those are disruptive winds.
There are more calls for people to wear a mask in public if they have flu or cold symptoms. Advice from health officials last week has been echoed by the head of NHS providers. Daniel O'Kelly says hospitals are dealing with a tidal wave of the virus, with some declaring major incidents. An interim report has warned of unacceptable care leading to tragic consequences in England's maternity units. Baroness Amos, who is leading the government review, says the situation is much worse than she expected. And a social media ban for under-16s has come into effect in Australia. Platforms including Instagram, TikTok and YouTube have been forced to delete more than a million accounts. The ban is designed to protect children from extreme material, but there are concerns it could do more harm than good. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 3 points at 96.42. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.14. LBC weather starting dull and wet this afternoon, but rain will become confined to the north later, brightening up in the south. A windy day with gales in the northwest, a high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
This Christmas at Tesco, 24 cans of Pepsi Max are just £7. That's down from £11.50 with your Tesco Club card. That's what makes it Christmas. Tesco. Every little helps. Majority of larger stores excludes Northern Ireland. Ends 31st of December. Club card or app required.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there. Good afternoon to you. If you're just joining us here at LBC, we have spoken on this programme many times together about your experiences of maternity care in England in particular. But we often get calls from elsewhere in the UK as well when we talk about it. And many of you talk not just about recent experience, but births going back, the birth of your child or children going back decades and what you experienced. The good sometimes comes through, the bad very often comes through, and the indifferent as well. And there's a pattern that's formed over the years in those calls, which in those conversations we've had, which I'm afraid has never really changed, which is that alongside your experiences, there is review after review after review. I mentioned a couple of them just a few moments ago in the lead up to the programme. Donna Ockenden review, she's currently still working on a particular one around a particular trust, the Kirkup review, the ongoing Care Quality Commission inspections, and the current National Maternity and Neonatal Investigation, which is led by Baroness Amos, who's kindly agreed to join us and talk to us about the review that she's undertaking. And I hope she'll be able to tell us that she's finding something that we don't already know, because I'm not sure that she will. Whether part of her review is to really get government not just thinking but acting quickly, swiftly, effectively to put right what is wrong. I don't know. She'll be able to tell us whether that's part of her remit. But frankly, on the basis of the probably thousands of conversations I've had with you over the years, we already know what's wrong because you've told us. And it's not just mothers and fathers who are telling us. Midwives have been telling us as well. I mentioned my sister a lot in this conversation, a recently, fairly recently retired midwife of decades of experience and commitment. And I know from being with her and over the years how much her commitment to her patients really mattered to her. But she talked very frankly with me over the years about the pressures that service was experiencing and her fears for it permeating down to patients and babies, mothers and babies, and whether they would one day be dealing with a maternal death. or a baby death that was avoidable. Because sometimes things aren't avoidable. Birth can be a very traumatic experience, and it's not always a survivable experience. Thankfully, it mostly is, but not always. And none of this is new to me, and none of it is new to you if you've been listening to the programme for the past decade. I remember interviewing Baroness Cumberledge when her review in 2016, Better Births, it was called, came out. And again, she was saying useful things and had found important truths in the course of her investigation. But one of the solutions to the shortage of midwives issue was to get midwives out of retirement. Experienced midwives in their late 50s, 60s, out of retirement. That's not workforce planning. That isn't workforce planning for a health service, for a service that is a very physical job. Again, you know, my sister used to show me the pedometer they used to wear it before your iPhone did it for you, your Apple Watch, sorry, did it for you. Many thousands of steps a day, like 20,000 steps a day, 30,000 steps a day, because of the marching around wards and back and forth that you were doing as part of your job. It is a very physical job, and it's a very skilled job. And there have been shortages of midwives for a long time, and that is absolutely part of this picture, but it's only part of the picture. There are cultural issues within some NHS trusts around midwifery, around cesarean births, for example. That's been firmly established by previous reviews, which again begs the question, what new will Baroness Amos be able to find out that can be useful to bring back to government? Is the government that's commissioned this review from her? What useful new things can she find so that quickly solutions, effective change can happen? Because I don't see it happening. If you do see it happening in the maternity unit that you work on or manage, and you feel able to call and you're allowed to call and tell us what those changes are, I'd be really interested to hear from you. If you're a midwife, retired or otherwise, who wants to give your take on what's been happening over the years in your specialism, I'd love to hear from you. I just think we're now looking at, not just in midwifery, we're looking at a kind of government, and I don't just mean this government, I mean a type of governance that we have in this country. Doesn't just apply to midwifery. We've